The Honorable Chief Justice and Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of California. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court, sitting in bank, is now in session. Please be seated.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the March session of the California Supreme Court. The clerk will call this morning's calendar.
So, on Tuesday, March 4th, 2008, at 9 a.m., is as follows. Case number S147999, In Re Marriage Cases. For the petitioner, City and County of San Francisco, Ms. Stewart.
Ready.
For the petitioners, Joshua Reimer et al., Mr. Minter. For petitioners Robin Tyler et al., Mr. Morocco.
Ready.
For the petitioners Gregory Clinton et al., Mr. McCoy.
Ready.
And for the respondent, State of California, Mr. Krueger.
Ready.
For the respondents, Arnold Schwarzenegger et al., Mr. Minnemeyer.
Ready.
For the respondents, Proposition 22, Legal Defense and Education Fund, Mr. Lavey.
Ready.
And for respondents, Campaign for California Families et al., Mr. Starver.
Ready.
I understand that among the petitioners, only Ms. Stewart and Mr. Minter will be reserving time for rebuttal, 5 minutes on behalf of each of them. We'll proceed first to hear from Ms. Stewart on behalf of the City and County of San Francisco.
Thank you, Chief Justice George. May it please the Court. I plan to focus my comments this morning on three areas, time permitting. First, domestic partnership and marriage are not equal. Second, there is no rational justification, or indeed any justification, for continuing to exclude lesbians and gay men from marriage. Third, by conditioning a marriage license on lesbians and gay men's waiver of their privacy autonomy right to intimate association, the state violates the unconstitutional conditions doctrine. Words matter. Names matter. We know that from cases like Sweat versus Painter and United States versus Virginia. In those cases, the Supreme Court held that the injustice of excluding blacks and women from institutions of higher learning that were highly regarded and rich in traditions and prestige could not be remedied by creating new and separate schools that lacked all of those qualities.
Is it your position that the use of the terminology marriage itself is part and parcel of the right to marry, and that that name could not be changed by the legislature or by the constitutional amendment that perhaps the electorate might put forth, even if it were applied to all persons?
Your Honor, it is our position that the state could not change the name marriage for a number of reasons, one of which is that it would be somewhat akin to Prince Edward's County deciding to shut down public schools just to avoid having to admit black people to them. If the reason to change the name marriage is to avoid having to allow lesbians and gay men access to that institution, it would violate equal protection. But even if the legislature could change the name, that doesn't matter in terms of our case today, because once the state has entered into the business, which it long ago did, of regulating marriage and of denying and granting access to marriage, it has to do that on an equal basis.
Well, that's what I want to focus on so that I understand fully your position. In the unlikely event that the legislature or a voter initiative were to determine that in order to distinguish civil marriage ceremonies from their religious counterparts, all persons, whether they were heterosexual couples or same-sex couples, would have their joinder termed, let's say, a civil union or domestic partnership, would that violate the rights that you invoke, or is it only because here there's a distinction between heterosexual couples and same-sex couples?
We believe it's both, Your Honor. We believe that the state has, by regulating marriage for so long and by placing the stamps the stamp of approval of the state, its imprimatur on the institution, it has enhanced the expressive and the dignitary interests that are involved. And so for the state to now pull out of it, again, I think it would raise serious concerns about liberty interests, but even more significantly concerns about equal protection if the reason for doing it were to avoid granting lesbians and gay men access to the institution.
But would you object if the state said marriage is really a religious institution, we are sanctioning civil unions, therefore we're going to call all of them civil unions? Would you object?
Yes, we would, Your Honor. The state actually adopted at its very first, at its constitutional convention, a part of the Constitution that said that the marriage would not turn on the tenets of any religious sect, that marriage was going to be governed by the state, that it would be, it's not just a custom, it's not just a religious institution, it's a legal institution. The
Didn't
state
that
has,
original Constitution expressly define marriage as between a man and a woman?
The Constitution did not define marriage, Your Honor. The laws at that time did, however. But as this Court said in People v. Belus, constitutional concepts are not static, and we have never confined ourselves to historic notions of equality. And so while the starting place sometimes for interpreting constitutional provisions may be the original Constitution, we then look to contemporary notions of equality and liberty, and those are reflected by the laws on the state's books. In this case, a whole panoply of laws that govern marriage itself and that govern the rights of lesbians and gay men.
Ms. Stewart, as I understand it, it's more or less a given that the state can define marriage and its attributes. What do you say to the opposing party's argument that tradition and history have always assumed, if not expressly said, that marriage is between a man and a woman, because that is the other argument that they will be making before us?
That's correct, Your Honor. And as I mentioned earlier, marriage isn't just a tradition. The state has made marriage into a legal institution. And like all legal institutions, marriage has to be held to constitutional standards. The idea that we uphold a law simply because it's been on the books for a long time has been rejected by this Court repeatedly, not only in cases applying strict scrutiny, Your Honor, but also in cases applying rational basis. In People v. Hofstra, the law that was challenged there definitely had roots in tradition, traditional beliefs about differences between different types of sexual acts, and the Court didn't stop that from letting it consider whether the law made sense in light of today's standards of equality and today's understandings.
But to the extent that you are invoking a rational basis standard for review, you set the hurdle higher for yourself, obviously, because tradition and history may very well provide some rational basis, arguably, at least the other side argues that, as compared to the strict scrutiny type of review that one would have with a suspect classification, which in this area, I suppose, is a less traditional area, but sets the barrier lower for you in that sense, although there has not been a court decision, I believe, that defines sexual orientation as a suspect class, and that perhaps gets us into that issue either at this point or later in the arguments.
Your Honor, it is correct that the strict scrutiny standard, which we do believe applies, is a higher test for the state to meet. However, it is not the case that tradition alone, the fact that we've done something for a very long time, is acceptable in and of itself as a basis for continuing a law, even under rational basis standard. This Court, in a case involving a distinction in between veterans' benefits for out-of-state citizens who moved here and citizens who were raised here, held that it wasn't rational, even though it had been on the state's books for quite a long time. And there are a number of other examples, Hofstra being one of them, where traditional laws were thrown out on rational basis. Gay law students is such a case. So tradition alone, you have to look at what's behind the tradition. What's the purpose for the tradition? And does that purpose still make sense today? Here, we're not talking about a tradition of men and women joining together in marriage. No one is advocating that we stop issuing marriage licenses to opposite-sex couples. The tradition that we're talking about is the tradition of excluding lesbians and gay men from the institution. That's the tradition we have to look for the purpose behind and decide, is that purpose rational in light of what our state's continuing standards or contemporary standards of equality are today.
Ms. Stewart.
How does the Domestic Partnership Act really recognize the sort of right to intimacy and right to privacy, and why isn't the Domestic Partnership Act basically co-equal in providing substantive rights that you're seeking in marriage?
It's not equal, Your Honor, and the fact that it may be well-intended and that it may make progress is certainly something that gay men and lesbians are appreciative of. But just because there's partial progress towards equality doesn't mean that something is full equality.
Doesn't this really just boil down to the use of the M word, marriage?
It does boil down. Well, let me back up. There are tangible rights and benefits at stake in today's debate, and we've discussed those at length in our supplemental brief. But you're right that more important than what divides the parties today is a symbol, and that symbol has deep meaning for people on both sides of the case. And if the symbol didn't have deep meaning, we wouldn't have eight parties here arguing the issue today, and we wouldn't have had 44 people join the case in, by way of amicus brief.
But do you concede that the state of California has made substantial progress in making domestic partners equal to marriage?
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree that the state has made progress, but even the legislature recognized...
Could you concede that the state has made substantial progress?
I do, Your Honor, but substantial equality is not equality. Substantial progress is not equality.
And is the primary inequality the federal marriage benefits?
It is not, Your Honor.
What are the other equalities that you seek?
Well, as I mentioned, there are a number of tangible differences that we lay out in our briefs, but more important than those, marriage has deep meaning. The name marriage matters. It communicates something that everybody understands. It communicates loyalty and intimacy and commitment. And it
Doesn't that place rhetoric over reality?
I don't think it does, Your Honor. I think if marriage had no deep meaning, the state could deny marriage and offer domestic partnership to any number of groups. For example, people over 50 or people who've been divorced or the infertile. And I don't think for a minute that anyone would stand for that. And why wouldn't they? Because people know what marriage means. It conveys a great deal. In Turner versus Safley, the court acknowledged that one of the key aspects, the attributes of marriage that's constitutionally protected, is its expressive function and its dignitary, the dignitary interest that it serves, the legitimacy that it gives to a couple and to children.
Counsel, a ruling in your favor would have no impact in terms of federal law and how other states will have different marriage statutes regard a marriage, same-sex marriage in California, is that correct?
That's not correct, Your Honor. There are several states now that do recognize marriages entered into in other states, even including marriages between couples who are people of the same sex. The federal government right now does not recognize those marriages at all because of the DOMA statute, but that may well change. The sense of equality that we have here in California is ahead of much of the rest of the nation.
Does it make it rational, then, for the state to give a different designation to the type of marriage that you're seeking because the other because federal government wouldn't recognize marriage in the traditional sense?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. What that communicates to other states and to the federal government and to other countries is that same-sex couples in California are not married, and the state is therefore indifferent to how those other states and countries treat their relationships. If the state said this is a marriage, it may be that some other states wouldn't recognize it, but it would be sending the message that California considers its lesbian and gay couples equal.
Let me ask you this, looking for a rational basis here. Would it be a rational basis for the state to say the federal government is denying certain benefits to persons who are same-sex couples? There's nothing we in California can do about it. There is a lot of bureaucracy or whatever you will about having to deal with two systems. It makes sense for us, for the purposes of the federal and state benefits, the different treatment, for us to give a different name to the same-sex couples because they inevitably have to go through a different process whenever they're dealing with the federal government. Would that on the rational basis test survive, and if not, would it survive under a higher standard of review?
It would not survive either, Your Honor. The truth is that whatever you call it, the administrative difficulties will be there until the federal government decides to recognize marriages between same-sex couples, and that will be true whether you call their relationships marriages or you call their relationships domestic partnership. The administrative nightmare that lesbians and gay men have been going through for a very long time with no recognition is improved by some recognition, but it still has a long way to go.
Now, you're speaking of equal protection denial to a particular group, and you have made reference to rational relationship test. Were you to argue strict scrutiny, you would require a protected class. And if that argument were made, how would you describe the protected class? Is it individuals, is it women and men who can't marry each other, or how would you describe it?
Your Honor, I would describe it. We do argue that. I just want to preface again that we talk about rational basis not because we think that strict scrutiny doesn't apply, but because if you don't meet that test, you necessarily don't meet the higher test. But to answer your question, we contend that marriage discriminates on gender lines, and so it is a gender class, but it is also the other strict scrutiny class that's implicated here is lesbians and gay men.
Now, let me stop you there, because you are approaching what I wanted to know. Are persons of a particular sexual preference a protected class? Has that ever been declared?
It has not in this court, Your Honor, and it has in some courts it has, but very few. I mean, and so that's the answer. The court has not reached the issue, and it has not held otherwise. It in many instances has struck down laws that were discriminatory and recognized some of the factors that lead to treatment as a suspect class in those decisions, but it was able to decide that the laws there involved were irrational and to decide them without reaching the question of whether strict scrutiny ought to be applied because of a suspect class. And those cases include Stueman and Vallerga and gay law students and a number of others. So we do believe that strict scrutiny applies here. We think that the state has actually conceded that all of the factors that we outlined in our brief that were critical to this court's decision that women were a suspect class in Sailor Inn are met here. That is a long history of discrimination, and that the criterion on which the group is discriminated against is not connected with their ability to perform. And so, and also the state has conceded that for purposes of equal protection, sexual orientation is immutable in the sense that it is fundamental to people's identity. It's something that people shouldn't be required to change, and that it's actually harmful to try to change it.
Ms. Stewart, assuming that you have finished your response, I'm trying to get a question in. So I figured, well, I hope you're ending your response so I can get my inquiry in. I have a threshold inquiry. As you well know, the opposing side has argued that when one takes a look at the state constitution, there is nothing in that state constitution that says there is a right to same-sex marriage. And I presume you would agree that there is no express language saying that, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
As I understand your position, you have taken the view that marriage is a fundamental right guaranteed by the state constitution. And again, when one takes a quick look at the state constitution, there is no express provision talking about the right to marriage. But as I understand the positions that have been articulated in this court, the parties agree that based on the court's decisions, the court has concluded, or the courts have concluded, that the Constitution provides an implicit right to marriage. I presume that's what your view is, right? Implicitly, there is a right to marriage in the Constitution. There is no express language, right?
That's correct.
And I presume that your next step of analysis, at least as I understand your position in the briefs, you then think that, from your perspective, it is important for this court to take a look at its previous decision in Perez versus Sharp, from 1948. And based upon that decision, you have argued to this court that the right of marriage includes freedom to choose one's spouse. Because as we know, in the Perez decision, the court, this court, extended the marriage right to interracial couples. And I presume further that you do not see a distinction between allowing interracial persons to marry and allowing persons of the same sex to marry. Is that right?
It's correct, Your Honor.
Next question. We've heard some observation on the part of members of this court that marriage is a bundle of legal rights. And I presume one can add to that, yes, it is indeed a bundle of legal rights that can be extinguished any time by the legislature. As I understand your position, marriage is much more than just a mere bundle of legal rights. At least as you have articulated in your brief, in addition, marriage consists of a core bundle of rights pertaining to privacy, autonomy, freedom of expression, association. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And I don't want to dominate the inquiry, so I have one more question to you. Earlier, a question was posed to you as to whether you concede that the state legislature's enactment of the domestic partnership law has provided gays and lesbians with very substantial rights. And you conceded that, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is it your view that by allowing domestic partners all the substantive rights and obligations of married couples, the state has effectively conceded there is no valid ground for distinction?
I think that's correct, Your Honor, but let me just say something a little bit broader, because I think there's been a little bit of looking narrowly as though the domestic partner law were the only reflection of this state's notions of equality in their contemporary form. And it is not only the domestic partner statute, but it is all of the laws that prohibit sexual orientation discrimination in housing, in employment, in insurance, in jury service, in custody, in adoption, in foster parenting. And those laws are a part of a tapestry that actually goes back even further than the statutes themselves to the decisions this court made in cases like Stueman and like Bayerga and like gay law students.
So what is the most...
That tapestry...
What is the most significant difference between domestic partnership and marriage? Is it that domestic partnership, according to your position, doesn't provide the title, status, or stature of marriage?
That is the most important distinction.
But aren't the rights and responsibilities substantially the same?
There are some differences, Your Honor, but they are close.
Aren't they substantially the same?
They're... Are the rights and the tangible
rights? Rights and responsibilities of domestic partners and marriage partners substantially the same?
The rights and benefits that are provided under state law are very close.
And therefore, doesn't that make the holding in Perez versus Sharp very different than this case?
Well, only if the court believes that Perez versus Sharp could have been decided by allowing the state to give interracial unions a different name from marriage. You know, it's not... This case is not about whether the domestic partnership law is fair or equal. This case is about whether denying marriage to lesbians and gay men is equal.
Let me ask you a related question, if I might. I agree with you that words matter and that the institution of marriage is unique. Would you agree that California is in the process of evolving its understanding of what that institution might encompass? We aren't the same state as we were when we adopted the Constitution.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And our views on this very topic are in the process of evolution.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, there is substantial difference of opinion about what that evolution should look like.
Yes, there is.
And the last time this issue was on the ballot, over 60% of the voters said they weren't ready to make this change. They said... In our judgment, those people who voted, 60% or better, said marriage should be between a man and a woman.
I don't think that's correct, Your Honor. What they said was, we don't want other states telling us how to define marriage, and therefore we are going to only recognize marriages from other states if they are between opposite sex couples.
You really think
that... Just if I could just finish. My question for you, and you may want to save your reply for rebuttal, is who decides where we are as Californians in this evolution of our understanding of the institution of marriage? Is it for this court to decide, or is it for the people of California to decide?
Your Honor, I would like to answer that question. And the answer is that when a law is challenged under the Constitution, this court's duty is to decide whether it meets constitutional principles of fairness and equality. And the court doesn't leave decisions like that to the political process for the same reason it didn't leave interracial unions to the political process in Perez, or it didn't leave whether women could be excluded from certain professions to the political process in Sailor Inn.
Does it matter that the statute that Justice Corrigan was referring to was an initiative that amended a statute rather than amending the Constitution?
It does not, Your Honor. When the people of California exercise their right to vote for an initiative, they're acting as the legislative branch.
Well, counsel, let me follow up on that. Let's assume that Family Code Section 308.5, adopted by the initiative process, contrary to your view, prohibited same-sex marriages contracted in California. Let's just assume that as a fact. Now, let's assume that the legislature didn't like that and immediately passed a statute rejecting that limitation. That act by the legislature would be unconstitutional, would it not be?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. So the legislature could not directly reject what the people adopted through the initiative process.
That's correct.
Okay. So now, instead of a direct attack, the legislature, with obviously good motives and intentions, has expanded the domestic partnership laws to give same-sex couples virtually equal rights, except for the title, that opposite-sex couples have. Isn't that correct?
I'm not sure I understand the beginning of your question.
My point, the question I'm asking is, taking into account that at the time Prop 22 was passed, virtually no government in the world defined marriage as same-sex. And the people of California, consistent with every government in the world, defined it the same way. What's happened since then, of course, there's been a sea change, attitude change. Certainly the legislature has stepped up to the plate, has passed the domestic partnership laws that I'm certain same-sex couples are very, very pleased with. My question is, if the legislature can't invalidate that act of the people directly, how is it that they can do so indirectly?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that they did indirectly change the marriage law. Let's assume for a moment, and I don't agree with, but I will take your premise of your question as an assumption, that Proposition 22, the 308.5, was intended more broadly to define marriage for purposes of California as well as marriages from other states. That's what it says is what marriage is, and the legislature could not change that constitutionally. Only the court could decide that that was unconstitutional. But to adopt another law that addresses rights and benefits and that gives a different title or status is not something precluded by expressly, and the court doesn't interpret initiatives to be broader than the words of the initiative are. So I think if I understand where the court's concern, your Honor's concern, Justice Baxter, is that, you know, is it the domestic partnership law itself that makes the denial of marriage irrational? And I do think that the domestic partner law highlights the irrationality of the denial of marriage, but it is by no means the only law on the books or the only policy of the state that makes that denial irrational. And I mentioned earlier the case law going way back and other statutes in a number of areas of law that predate the domestic partner statute.
Is it your position that the concept of equal protection and who may or may not be a protected class evolves? And were we hearing this case 50 years ago, well, perhaps we wouldn't be hearing this case because none of the foundations for recognition of what you would now call discrimination against same-sex couples wouldn't have existed. So my question is, does the concept of equal protection evolve?
It does, Your Honor, and this Court has said that a number of times. You know, just because society doesn't see a law or a practice as unequal until a later point in time doesn't mean the practice wasn't always unequal or always unjust, but it means that we were, as a society, were blind to it. And that's what Justice Kennedy said when he said in the Lawrence case that times can blind us to certain truths that later generations can see. And in
why is this the moment of truth as opposed to 10 years from now after more evolution may have occurred, which is, I think, the premise of some of my colleagues' comments and questions?
I think the concern expressed by your colleague, Justice Corrigan, is a valid one, but basically, we're here today. We've raised the issue today. The court has to look at the standards of equality that exist in contemporary society and how contemporary society views marriage, which I might note has undergone considerable change from what it was, as I think Chief Justice George mentioned earlier, at the very beginning of our statehood. Marriage was a completely different institution. You wouldn't recognize it if you time traveled from the 19th century to today, because marriage at that time was coverture. Everyone understood that marriage meant that the woman had no separate identity and that the man had control over every aspect, essentially, of the marital relationship.
Aren't there many changes, including the concept of divorce, certainly property, dowries, polygamy, which became outlawed, rights of parents over their children to make certain decisions, interracial marriage, contraception in marriage, even criminalization of marital rape, and the whole concept of civil marriage as opposed to religious marriage, at least, has gone through an evolution that makes it a somewhat different institution today than it was 100 or 150 years ago, isn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor. And some of that change has been at the hands of this court. Sometimes in the common law arena, like cases like DeBerg, where the court recognized a form of no-fault divorce, and then the legislature followed that. And cases like Perez, where the court held that a tradition that was on our state's books since at the time of statehood and that was dated back to colonial times was no longer constitutional in light of current standards of equality. So what the court
did the Perez court really look at evolving notions of marriage? I mean, I think at the time, interracial marriage was prohibited in most of the United States, and it was something that if you took a poll then, it would have been frowned upon, just as, I don't know how the polls would be now as to same-sex marriage, but certainly at that time, interracial marriage was frowned upon.
I think that's correct. What the court looked at were contemporary notions of equality, but not necessarily contemporary notions of that particular aspect of marriage. And the court in Perez did something really striking. I mean, it it held that interracial marriage bans were unconstitutional at a time when no other court had done that, and when 16 other courts had done precisely the opposite.
Isn't the I'm not sure I agree with the assumption that interracial marriage was permitted, if that's what you were saying, in most states. I think
the opposite is true.
Oh, good. I misunderstood, because I believe there were something like 33 states at the end of World War II that prohibited interracial.
That's correct, Your Honor. If I said that, I terribly
maybe
misspoke.
Maybe I misunderstood.
No, it was the opposite. Most states still have those laws on the books, and in states that were older than California, they did go all the way back to colonial times before we were a nation. And some states had those laws in their state constitutions, and this court stepped up and looked at the law in light of the Constitution and said it wasn't constitutionally permissible.
All right, I'm afraid your time is up, assuming you wish to reserve your time for rebuttal.
I do, thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Minter.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Shannon Minter here for the Reimer petitioners. Your Honors, the very fact that our
Excuse me, I wonder if you could either speak more loudly or changing the position of the mic.
My apologies. Your Honors, the very fact that our state legislature has been willing to extend extensive tangible marital benefits to same-sex couples, but has insisted on retaining a separate name, shows how much the status and the word marriage do matter.
Does this ironically put the state in a worse position in terms of defending the constitutionality of its laws than if it had not extended these rights and privileges to same-sex couples?
I do not think there is any irony there, Your Honor. It goes to the question that the court has been focused on about when did lesbians and gay men acquire the right to marry, when did they acquire the right to equal protection. I think it's important to be clear on this point that lesbians and gay men have always had the same fundamental rights as everyone else, including the fundamental right to marry, certainly have always had the same right to equal protection.
Mr. Minter, I presume that probably you may recall the inquiry that I posed earlier to Ms. Stewart pertaining to domestic partnership. I'll try to rephrase it. By allowing domestic partners all of the substantive rights and obligations of married couples, what is your response to the argument that in doing that, the state has effectively conceded that there is no valid ground for distinction?
I think that is exactly right, Your Honor, that what the state, by acknowledging that same-sex couples and their children are entitled to equal treatment, entitled to the same dignity and respect, as well as the tangible benefits, they have acknowledged that the state has now awakened to the reality that lesbian and gay people are entitled to all of the same fundamental rights as heterosexual couples, including the fundamental right to marry, which includes the name.
So is the message to individual legislators that if they vote in favor of progressive legislation, they stand the risk of enshrining that legislation within the Constitution?
Not at all, Your Honor. This is a part of the way our constitutional system works. We have awakened to the entitlement to equality of many groups that were previously shut outside of legal rights and protections. Just as the U.S., by analogy, the U.S. Supreme Court in Lawrence v. Texas held that Bowers v. Hardwick had been wrong the day it was decided and was wrong now. It was not that the law suddenly changed in 2003, but that the court had awakened to the full humanity of gay people and to a fuller notion of what liberty and equality requires. That's the way our constitutional system works.
Well, customarily, our constitutional system works on the basis of the democratic process. And the question here is that I have for you, sir, is the same that I had for Ms. Stewart. Who gets to decide when we get there?
Now, whether lesbian and gay people must be permitted to marry is not ultimately a policy issue or a legislative issue. It's ultimately a constitutional question for this court to decide.
I agree that it is a constitutional question, but you would agree, would you not, that when the Constitution was enacted in this state, very few people contemplated that the institution of marriage would be so broad as to include people of the same gender.
When this court looks at our state constitution and construes the rights that are protected under the state constitution, it doesn't hold itself bound to the narrow features of what would have been understood by a particular word or right in 1849 or 1879.
I appreciate that you would reject the original intent doctrine. But would you agree that the original understanding, whatever its significance today, would not have been understood so broadly in the context of this institution?
I don't think there would have been any intent one way or another at the time our Constitution was created, drafted, with regard to same-sex couples in marriage. It's not an issue that would have been had presented itself at that time.
Well, okay. Let's assume that I'm willing to go that far with you. Would you also agree that we are in the process of evolving our understanding of what might be involved in this institution?
I think the California Constitution is in itself the highest expression of the will of the people, and the people have entrusted this court to enforce its guarantees. And we do have guidance. We have the principles that this court enunciated in Perez v. Sharp.
So this is really a false dichotomy in a way of saying, is it for the court to decide for the people? Because your view is that the Constitution is the ultimate expression of the people's will. Restraints that the people have imposed upon their legislative authority and the authority of their elected representatives, so that it's not really a question of courts versus the people, but rather the people's own expression in the Constitution. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor, that is absolutely correct.
All right. Do you concede that the state can place some limits on the right to marry?
Certainly, Your Honor.
And the state has expressly limited multiple spouses.
Yes.
And that's appropriate. There's a rational basis for that.
At least a rational basis, yes, Your Honor.
And the state has expressly prohibited underage spouses. And
yes.
There's a rational basis for that.
Yes.
And the state has prohibited blood related spouses.
Yes.
And there's a rational basis for that.
Yes.
But you argue that there is no rational basis for same-sex prohibition.
That is correct, Your Honor. In the case of prohibitions on incest, for example, the marriage by people who are too closely related, the state has compelling reasons to restrict that, based not just on concerns about genetically related folks having children, but about preventing coercion and abuse and protecting integrity of families. There are absolutely no similar concerns about permitting same-sex couples to marry. That would strengthen families, that would protect children. With regard to any restriction, it has to be justified by a legitimate or compelling state interest. It has to be related to the purposes of marriage. There's absolutely nothing about a person's gender or sexual orientation that in any way is relevant to the purposes, the legitimate state purposes served by marriage.
So was the electorate irrational in adopting Prop 22 and specifically Family Code Section 308.5 in its limitation of marriages contracted in California to be limited to opposite sex couples?
Yes, Your Honor, our position is that the restriction in Section 308.5, which is set forth in our briefs, applies to out-of-state marriages, but assuming the premise of your question that it also applied to in-state marriages, it would absolutely be irrational. It constitutes a discrimination. It lacks even a legitimate state purpose, much less the compelling state purpose that it would have to have under heightened scrutiny, because this is the fundamental right to marry.
Even though at that time no government in the world defined marriage to include same-sex couples.
Of course, the same objection could have been put forward and was very strenuously put forward by the state in Perez v. Sharp.
Well, Perez involved marriage as traditionally defined. Perez involved opposite-sex couples, and the discrimination in Perez involved racial discrimination. Isn't that correct? And in 1946, do you really think that in 1946, that's a long time ago, I was 6 years old, that the court even had in mind the concept of same-sex marriage in the Perez case?
I think that the principles that the court enunciated and the fundamental constitutional values that the court enunciated in Perez are directly applicable to this case.
But it was in the context of marriage as traditionally defined and marriage prohibiting interracial marriage. I mean, that's what Perez was all about.
Well, it's the genius that courts enunciate fundamental constitutional values and principles, and then they have to apply those principles to new issues and new cases. That happens all the time. And the principles that this court set forth in Perez do directly apply here, that there's a fundamental right to marry and that the essence of that right is the freedom to marry the person of one's choice.
Mr. Minter, I would agree with you that the Constitution is the highest proclamation of the people's understanding of the law they choose. So articulate for me where in that document, the Constitution of the State of California, you find a basis for the outcome that you are arguing for.
Multiple bases. I believe that all constitutional roads do lead to the same result here, which is that same-sex couples are entitled to the fundamental right to marry. Fundamental right to marry itself is protected. It's a protected liberty interest under the state due process clause. It's protected under the state privacy clause. It's protected by the right of intimate association. There's also very important equal protection interest at stake here because the current marriage statute facially discriminates based on sexual orientation and also based on sex. Established that classifications based on sex get heightened scrutiny. Classifications based on sexual orientation also under this court's, the criteria that this court applies to determine when a classification is subject to strict scrutiny should also be subject to strict scrutiny. So there are multiple avenues, constitutional principles here that all do converge on the same result.
Is there not also a principle that if there is a problem that the legislature seeks to address, the legislature is not required to solve the problem all at once? It may do so incrementally. And if that is a true principle, would you explain why it doesn't apply here?
Yes, Your Honor. That principle has no application when we're talking about a fundamental right or a suspect classification. When a statute like the current California marriage statute directly infringes on a right that has already been established to be constitutional, that principle of giving the legislature some leeway to be over and under inclusive has absolutely no application. It's also true with regard to classifications that discriminate based on a suspect classification like sexual orientation or gender. However, even if we were only under a rational basis of review, which should not be applied here because there is a fundamental right in suspect classifications, any line the legislature draws has to have some rationality. There has to be that connection between the asserted state purpose and where the state chooses to draw the line. And this court has been very clear about that in Hampshire and other cases. And here, that rational connection is simply completely lacking. There is no even legitimate state purpose that is served by excluding same-sex couples from marriage.
Mr. Minter, is sexual orientation an immutable characteristic like race or gender?
Absolutely, yes, it is.
Well, since your answer is yes, would you be so kind, if you're able to do so, is there any evidence in the record on this particular point?
No, and there does not need to be, Your Honor. This court, in prior cases, when deciding whether a classification is entitled to strict scrutiny and whether a particular characteristic is immutable, has decided those questions as a matter of constitutional fact, a matter of constitutional law.
But there hasn't been a decision classifying sexual orientation as a suspect class, has there?
That is the question before this court.
And you've, and I'd like you to address both the argument based on gender and the argument based on sexual orientation. The burden that you have with regard to sexual orientation is that there's been no case holding, and it's raised in this issue. The burden that I think you have with regard to gender is that the laws seem to treat males and females equally in this regard, that both genders are precluded from marrying persons of the opposite sex. So conceptually, I have difficulty with the more traditional approach, and I'm interested in your approach to the non-traditional avenue that you're invoking.
Well, with regard to sexual orientation, I think all the parties agree that a person's sexual orientation is not relevant generally to their ability to participate in or contribute to society. And also the state has conceded and the legislature has established as a matter of policy and law, with regard to the more particular issue here, sexual orientation is not relevant to ability to enter into committed relationships or to be parents, any of the attributes that are relevant to the issue of marriage. There's also no dispute here about the history of discrimination. The Court of Appeal raised an issue about immutability. For constitutional purposes, immutability means a trait that is so central to a person's identity, it would be repugnant, it would be abhorrent for the government to try and penalize a person for refusing to change it. And sexual orientation clearly meets that test. It's a central and defining aspect of a person's identity, as this court has acknowledged in Koepke. And the state has no legitimate interest in trying to force someone to change their sexual orientation.
Mr. Minter, just a point of clarification on the issue of sexual orientation. Is sexual orientation discrimination a particular form of gender discrimination, or are these two concepts completely different?
They are intimately related, and particularly so in a statute that is about couples. Sexual orientation is by definition a relational term. If a person is a gay man is attracted to and loves men, a lesbian is attracted to and loves women, it's about that relation. So when a statute, for example, the marriage statute at issue here restricts a right or benefit to a different sex couple, that by definition creates a classification based on sexual orientation. I think that creates a facial classification.
Mr. Minter, there was one matter that I did not get a chance to ask Ms. Stewart about, and that is Proposition 22 and her argument that it was meant to apply only to out-of-state marriages. Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it's based on?
It's based on the ballot materials that were presented to the voters in Proposition 22. I think that principle has been very clearly enunciated by this court that what's the most relevant factor in construing the meaning of an initiative is how it is presented to the voters. The ballot materials were all about protecting California's sovereignty and not having California forced to accept marriages of same-sex couples from other jurisdictions. The language of the initiative itself is ambiguous, and so the court would need to look to those ballot materials. Also, its placement in the code, in Family Code Section 308.5. Section 308 is about recognition, establishes the general rule that California will generally treat marriages from other jurisdictions as valid or recognize them for limited purposes. This measure was put forward as an amendment to 308, created Section 308.5.
If we were to agree with you, how does that make your argument easier?
Even if you did not agree with us and this court were to find that Section 308.5 applies to in-state marriages, it would be unconstitutional then for exactly all of the same reasons that Section 300 is unconstitutional. The fact that a measure is enacted by an initiative doesn't change the constitutional analysis whatsoever. Initiative measures are subject to exactly the same constitutional limitations as a statute enacted by the legislature. So in that sense, it would not change the legal analysis.
Getting back to the immutability factor in sexual orientation, you indicated that that all counsel conceded as to the definition of immutability. Is it not an issue in this case?
The Attorney General has conceded that. I believe the governor is not disputing that. Some of the other parties in the case have raised that as a question.
And what is the definition of legal immutability that at least the Attorney General and your parties concede?
A trait that is so central to a person's identity that it either can't be changed or should not have to be changed. I do think sexual orientation clearly meets that definition. Immutability does not require that a characteristic is biologically or genetically caused. I do think the Court of Appeal was erroneous to suggest that the petitioners in this case should have put forward some kind of evidence about the genetic causation of sexual orientation. What matters is that sexual orientation is an integral aspect of identity, that for the vast majority of people it is fixed. A gay person cannot choose to become heterosexual any more than a heterosexual person can choose to become gay. Why or how it's fixed is absolutely of no legal relevance to the equal protection or fundamental right issues.
There was no evidence on this presented to the trial court. It was not an issue that was presented to the court.
That's correct.
When did same-sex couples acquire the constitutional right to marry?
Lesbians and gay men have always had the same constitutional right to marry as others. What has changed is the ability of courts and society to recognize that entitlement to equality and recognize that the justifications that historically have been put forward to justify keeping lesbian and gay people out of marriage do not have merit.
So from the date the Constitution was adopted?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
1847?
Yeah, in exactly the same way that women have always had a protected constitutional right to serve on juries or to be employed in any of the any occupations available to men, or that African American people were always entitled to the full panoply
of
constitutional...
Did you say always?
Yes, Your Honor.
I may be misunderstanding things, but I thought that my limited knowledge of history shows that there have been long traditions of discrimination. And when you mention women and professions and say always, that's where I beg to differ with you. Way back, there was a very long tradition of treating a wife as the property of the husband. There was a long tradition of not allowing women to vote. So are you still with always?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that there was always the underlying human right, the human interest and entitlement. Now, that's not to say that courts, of course, had not always recognized that right, or that society itself had recognized that women, people of color, lesbian and gay people had the same fundamental rights as others. It is that awakening where the evolution takes place.
So you're saying those rights always existed in the abstract, they just were not formally recognized by institutions until a later time.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
And I presume, to follow up on the Chief Justice's question, implicit in your response is that just because there has been a long tradition of something or other doesn't mean that that tradition is legally right or constitutionally protected.
Absolutely. The mere invocation of tradition itself is never sufficient to establish a legitimate state interest. Traditions have to be supported by some underlying rationale or value. In this case, for example, the tradition of marriage is valuable and important because marriage provides very important benefits to individuals and to society. By contrast, while one can use the label of tradition to the longstanding practice of excluding lesbian gay people from marriage, it's really a mislabeling. The fact that that practice has been going on and continuing for a long period of time does not in itself give it any legitimacy or value, and it's really a misuse of the word tradition to call that a tradition. It's a long-standing
Perez
practice.
Perez was decided in 1948. Does that case expressly or implicitly support your position with respect to sexual orientation?
Perez is directly on point.
Expressly or implicitly?
Well, Perez did not expressly talk about lesbian gay couples, obviously, or address same-sex couples expressly. However, the principles enunciated in Perez are expressly applicable to this case.
How so?
That marriage is more than a contract. It is a fundamental civil right. That marriage, that permitting individuals to choose the person that they marry without unjustified interference from the state is an absolutely irreducible aspect of human dignity and autonomy. Those principles apply here.
So when the court said that there was a right to marry a person of one's choice, do you think the court was thinking about the situation we're facing today?
I think the court was thinking that the choice of whom to marry is such an intimate, personal, and important choice that affects the course of a person's lifetime, and that it is, by definition, people marry the one person, want to marry the one person who to them is irreplaceable. We demean ourselves as a society, we demean ourselves collectively, if we do not give individuals that freedom to choose whether to marry and whom to marry. And I do believe those principles are absolutely directly applicable to the situation of lesbian and gay people who...
Perez involved a suspect class, acknowledged suspect class of race, and the fundamental right to marry. Do we have to agree with you that sexual orientation is a fundamental, is a suspect class in order to apply Perez to this case?
No. No, Perez, the fundamental right to marry itself is sufficient to rule in favor of the petitioner's claims in this case.
I take it that you would place some reliance upon the language of this court in Perez. Two sentences I would point out. Certainly the fact alone that the discrimination has been sanctioned by the state for many years does not supply such justification, meaning for the discrimination. And secondly, since the essence of the right to marry is freedom to join in marriage with a person of one's choice, a segregation statute for marriage necessarily impairs the right to marry. You view that as analogous to the situation here, and if so, why?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, that point is also directly on point, that the mere persistence of historical discrimination over time, even when, as in Perez, it's supported by overwhelming public opinion, by precedent from other jurisdictions, does not in itself have any constitutional significance. The court has to look at the fundamental constitutional values that are protected in our state constitution, which includes the fundamental right to make personal decisions that are so central and so have so much impact on a person's social and personal destiny that the government should not reach in and interfere with those decisions.
Let me ask you the same question I asked Ms. Stewart. If the state came to the realization that marriage is really a religious institution and the state is only sanctioning a civil union and changed the title to civil unions, would you object?
Yes, very much so.
Well, would you force priests, rabbi, and ministers who oppose same-sex marriage to marry same-sex people?
No. That
how do you how does the state manage that problem?
Religious marriage and secular civil marriage, marriage is a legal civil institution, are completely distinct under current law. That would not change in any way, shape, or form if same-sex couples are permitted to marry. I would like to return to the first part of your question, though. Even before California was a state, there was a federally constitutionally protected right to marry. So, of course, California has to honor that right. California cannot simply abolish marriage for everyone. The right to marry is also protected by the California Constitution, and a part of the substance of the fundamental right to marry is the word and the status of marriage itself. And marriage is protected as a fundamental right because marriage itself, as a status, as an experience, apart from the material benefits that are provided through marriage at any given time, mean something, and that meaning is part of what is constitutionally protected.
Mr. Minter, how are you defining the term marriage?
Marriage is a civil institution recognized and sanctioned by the state, and it has substantive meaning. For most people, marriage doesn't just express but actually makes possible a unique deepening and a quality of commitment.
I'm looking for a definition here. So if I'm looking it up in your dictionary, what definition am I going to find there?
Civil marriage is a legal institution and a status made available by the state so that two people can intertwine their lives together and so that their private commitment to one another can be publicly acknowledged and validated. And that is the constitutionally core protected definition of marriage for constitutional purposes.
And what is the definition of a civil union?
Civil union is a purely functional status. It's an arbitrary label that's attached to a collection of material rights and benefits.
Oh, but the material surrounding the adoption of the domestic partner statute in California goes much deeper than that, don't you agree? Doesn't it really respect the rights of the individuals involved?
The legislature, in enacting our domestic partnership laws, made clear that they believe that lesbians and gay men should be entitled to the same dignity and respect and protection as heterosexual couples, and acknowledged expressly in the findings to the marriage bill that was enacted and voted on by the legislature in 2005 and again in 2007 that the domestic partnership statute is not sufficient in that way. The most important aspect of the fundamental right to marry is the dignity and the protection, the public validation, and the meaning of the marital bond, the meaning of that relationship to the persons involved and to all of society.
Isn't the element of choice critical to that? Quoting again from Perez v. Sharp, the right to marry is the right to join in marriage with the person of one's choice. And you view that as something outside the limits of just a racial restriction. You take that language and feel that it should be extended to the situation we have here. Is that correct?
As the U.S. Supreme Court in Zablocki said, marriage is of fundamental importance to all persons. And that decision about whether to marry implicates a person's most deeply held values and beliefs. Right now, heterosexual persons in California are allowed to make that decision, act on their own most authentic choices and beliefs.
Why doesn't the same argument apply to an individual who wants to be married to two people? Their choice.
Or to their cousin.
There are compelling state interests that justify restricting marriage between persons who are too closely related. With regard to the institution of polygamy, same-sex couples could marry in California without requiring any substantive change apart from ending the discriminatory exclusion to the substantive rights and duties of marriage, because those substantive rights and duties do not depend on the respective genders of the spouses in any way. Husbands and wives are absolutely similarly situated. The same is not true if the state were to contemplate allowing more than two people to marry. That would require a very wholesale, drastic revision of our existing marriage laws.
All right, your time is up. Well, Justice Baxter,
let me just
question,
ask,
and then
yeah.
Your time will be up.
In the polygamous situation, let's just assume for the sake of argument that there has, over the next 5 years, there's a sea change, an attitude change, and the legislature reacts to it and extends domestic partnership status to multiple couples. Would your position still be the same?
Yes, sir, it would. It would. It is a different institution than bilateral marriage.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Minter. We'll now hear from Mr. Morocco.
Honor.
Take a moment if
you wish. Sure. Musical chairs here.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. Let's just start off with following up, if I may, on Justice Corrigan's question about what is marriage, and cite to the U.S. Supreme Court in Griswold versus Connecticut, which defines that marriage. The court there said, marriage is the coming together, for better or for worse, hopefully enduring and intimate of the degree of being sacred. Marriage is an association as noble as any. That was the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Griswold. And I take from that.
Is it your position that when those words were written, the author and the other members of the court who joined with him anticipated that those sweeping words would encompass same-sex marriage?
No, I don't think it was in their mind at that point, because at that point there was a different issue before the court, and society was different at that point in time.
Okay, so if that is, to me, the essential question here. If society is different now from what it was when Griswold was decided, how can we say that the majority of Californians are ready to say, we've turned the corner, we've made this change, we now, as the body politic, are prepared to embrace this new definition?
Your Honor, the majority of Californians in 1948 were not ready. The majority of the United States in 1967 and Loving weren't ready. I submit to the court that if a vote was taken today in some of the states in our union, there would still be a close call, if not a minority of the voters would be in favor of interracial marriage today.
That may be true, unfortunately.
Yes.
But there is a constitutional amendment that bans discrimination on the basis of race. So there is a constitutional foundation for Loving and Perez and all of those cases that have found constitutionally unsupportable discrimination based on race, without question. It took us about 100 years to honor that constitutional change, but we finally got there. And we got there because the courts said we had to honor the Constitution.
Your Honor,
my question here is, where in the California Constitution do we find support for the definition of marriage which you are now urging?
Your Honor, I take issue with the fact that Loving and Perez were decided solely on the issue of race. Those cases say there's a constitutional right to the fundamental right to marriage. That's not found in the Constitution either.
But at the time, marriage was defined and understood, rightly or wrongly, to be the union of a man and a woman. So it seems to me a little facile to go back to those cases and say that a term that was used then and virtually universally understood, rightly or wrongly, to mean a opposite gender union, suddenly was transformed by revisionist history to mean something different.
Yes, Ryan, but I may posit this hypothetical, if I may. If the electorate in California were to pass an initiative this November that said that prisoners, even prisoners on death row, are not allowed to get married, this court, I submit, would strike that down as being unconstitutional, even though the electorate said so. Why? Because there's a fundamental right to marry that's been recognized by the U.S. Supreme Court. A person on death row can be married by a rabbi, by a priest, by a pastor, yet a gay and lesbian couple can't. Does that make any sense?
In that regard, do you have anything to say about this court's decision in Mulkey versus Reitman? Are you familiar with that?
No, Your Honor.
Well, that was a situation where there was an initiative that invalidated the fair housing laws. And this court was called upon to decide whether or not that violated the Constitution, whether that initiative measure did. And the court, despite the people's expression of their will with regard to housing, did find that initiative unconstitutional.
I would agree with that decision, Your Honor, if that means anything. But there's also a hypothetical I was thinking about this morning in all candor. We're talking about the change in our society. All the justices have talked about it's an evolving process. Let's give it some time. The Attorney General has argued that in his brief. It's a primary core theory that in the last 5-6 years, since these cases were filed, look what's happened. give it some time. It's taken time. Take 100 years to get rid of slavery. Hundreds of years. Give it some time. We're just reacting too quickly. We're too worried about what the public's going to react. Are they going to accept this? Valid questions. But I'm going to pose a hypothetical here. Let's assume the demographics and politics of California were such. It's possible it could happen. We are a strange political state, to say the least. We all know that. That the body politic was such that the legislature tomorrow passed a law. They convened and they said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to flip-flop, reverse Section 300A of the Family Code and 297. They can do that. It's not a fundamental right, according to a number to the opposition and some of the questions on this court. So we can do that. We'll define marriage as a civil contract, as 300, a civil contract between a man and a man, and a woman and a woman. And a registered domestic partner, what's that going to be under 297? We decide that that should be a civil contract between heterosexual couples. They can do it. It's not a fundamental right, according to them. I wonder whether the Attorney General will be sitting here today on my left, and this court will be asking questions about saying, well, supporting of that legislation. It's the will of the people. Who are we to decide? The democratic process. Let them do what they want to do. There's no right in the Constitution to marry. I can't see a Section 1, whatever, saying you have a right to marry. Section 1, Article 1, Section 1 doesn't define marriage as a defined concrete right. So therefore, the legislature can say only same-sex couples can get married. Since married doesn't mean anything, Justice Chin said, what's the difference ultimately between the domestic partnership law and marriage? I agree. Substantially, it's the same. Substantial rights. There's some little differences, but tweaking, but it's not major. It's the federal problem. I agree with the court.
Mr. Marocco, you may soon be running out of time.
Yes.
I do have one question.
Yes.
We've heard a lot about tradition, and as you know, the opposite side relies heavily on tradition as to marriage being a legal union between a man and a woman. Is it your view that in this particular case, the real issue is not whether there is a long-standing tradition, etc., etc., but the real issue, at least as perceived by your side, is whether there is anything inherent in the institution of marriage or in its constitutionally significant attributes that justifies or requires a gender-based restriction to opposite gender couples?
I agree, Your Honor, with the court's take.
I beg your pardon?
I agree with the court. With the court's.
That was a question.
Yeah.
I still need a response.
Yes.
Oh, you said I agree, so I presume that
yes.
is your response.
I agree with the court. What the court said. Yes, Your Honor. I adopt that decision, Your Honor. In closing, Your Honor, give me a few more minutes, if I may. Last I looked, Massachusetts is still a state in good standing. It's functioning. It's not fallen into the Atlantic. And if California, if this court finds Section 300 and 308.5 does impinge upon fundamental rights of not only sex discrimination, but but sexual orientation discrimination, and is unconstitutional, I don't think California is going to fall into the Pacific.
If we were to agree with you that it is unconstitutional, would not the people, through their initiative power, be entitled to amend the Constitution to reverse this court's decision?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm sure that tomorrow, if that were to happen, there would be initiative ballots being distributed to do that. But that initiative itself, in our opinion, would be, if it were passed, would be unconstitutional. You can't take away a fundamental right to marry. You can't, by initiative, allow gender discrimination.
So then the Constitution would be in conflict with itself?
How would we get
to your conclusion if the people by initiative amend the Constitution?
The Constitution would be, that amendment, if they were adopted and incorporated into the Constitution, would be violated. This court would hopefully decide that it would violate the U.S. Constitution. that the U.S. Constitution wouldn't allow the state constitution to say that blacks can't marry whites.
Well, we're not talking about that.
The U.S. Constitution would not allow to say that a man can't marry a man or a woman can't marry a woman because that is gender discrimination.
Okay, so your position is that we could indeed base a decision that comes to the consequence that you want under the federal constitution.
This court would, in that hypothetical, would have to go to federal law at the state
constitution. Well, I'm assuming that the federal constitution will not have changed in the interim. So your position now is that the federal constitution demands this outcome.
I think, Your Honor, the state constitution demands it, and the federal. That amendment would be in conflict with Article 1, Section 1, and Article 1, Section 7, if it were to pass. There would be a conflict within the constitution. You can't, by constitutional amendment, say in one paragraph, you have a liberty right, you have a due process right, you have a right against gender discrimination, and then have another section next to it saying you can discriminate based on gender and sexual orientation. So it's a conflict within the Constitution. That would create a conflict.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Morocco.
Thank you,
Your Honor. Time is up. We'll hear now from Mr. McCoy.
May it please the Court. My name is Joaquin McCoy. I represent the Clinton petitioners in this case. And I want to start by saying that it appears to be the court's view that what the petitioners are doing is redefining marriage. And that's not what's happening here. We're not redefining marriage. Marriage.
But you say it's the court's view. Is that based on certain questions from the court that leads you to that conclusion?
Just based on the questions of the court and also looking at the opinion from the Court of Appeals. Where I thought that they...
Well, there you have something substantive because it's out. You don't know where we're going to rule.
That's correct. Well, I don't know where you're going, Your Honor, and that's true. And I guess my point is that the right that we're talking about here is the right to marry. You can put words before it, interracial marriage, same-sex marriage, genderless marriage, but the fact remains we're talking about marriage. And marriage... This court has said marriage is a fundamental right that individuals, not groups, individuals have a right to choose their life partners. And in Perez, I know the court has talked about Perez, and what I want to say about Perez, it is analogous to this case because in Perez, the state was coming in and choosing the life partner of the people who wanted to wed.
But of course, as you may well recall, when that... argument was articulated, I think, by Ms. Stewart earlier on. There was a question from the bench, and I think it was a question posed by Justice Baxter, pointing out that in Perez versus Sharp, the issue pertained to interracial marriages, not marriages between persons of the same sex.
And I agree. That case did deal with marriages between couples who were heterosexual. But in that case, it also ruled that marriage is a fundamental right, and it is a right for an individual to choose their life partner. And here, what we're saying is the state has enacted statutes which prevent Californians from choosing their life partners.
Does this not go back to the def? Here I am. Does this not go back to the definition of marriage? I mean, I know this is somewhat circular, but in Perez, as has often been referenced, it was said that it's the right to marry a person of choice, but before the court at that time was interracial marriage, and cases are not definitive resolutions for issues not before them. So the reference to person of your choice would have been made in the context of that case. And as you observed, the Court of Appeal assumed that the definition of marriage is this union between a man and a woman, and that what your clients and others were seeking is the right to same-sex marriage. So if we were to define it the way the Court of Appeal did, would we not have to reach a different conclusion than what you are urging us?
Well, I think the Court of Appeal was incorrect in its definition of what we're seeking here. And I think that's...
How do we know what the definition of marriage is in this particular respect,
okay,
between whom it can be?
Okay. The definition of marriage, which we are asserting here, is the commitment between two individuals to provide love and emotional support to one another for the rest of their
lives. With all due respect, I understand that's the definition that you are advancing, but how does this court know that implicit with all the commitment and the choice and so forth is not the understanding that it's between a man and a woman?
Well, I think history and tradition has showed that marriage, the common understanding of marriage, is between a man and a woman. However, our focus here is whether the statute and the common understanding of marriage is unconstitutional on its face, whether the definition excludes individuals in California for the right of free choice, that is, right to choose their life partner. And I think that's the focus here is deciding on whether the statutes presented are unconstitutional because it denies a group of people or an individual a right of free choice. And here, these statutes, 300 and 308.5, define marriage as between a man and a woman. We believe the Constitution is clear under the Equal Protection Clause of the state Constitution that you can't allow one group the rights and privileges of this state and deny another. Here we're saying gays and lesbians are being denied that right which is offered to opposite sex couples. And so we believe that the court should strike down those statutes. We know that law is ever so evolving and law is flexible in our, you know, we're progressing in our society. And we do have domestic partnership laws, which we've been talking about today. However, that is a system that is two-tiered, and essentially there are intangible benefits.
Well, getting back to the issue of tradition, which has been mentioned various times in this proceeding, is preserving tradition, and in particular preserving the traditional understanding of marriage, is that a legitimate governmental interest for the purpose of equal protection analysis?
I think no. It's not a rational basis.
And why not?
Well, because I look at the cases of Perez and Loving. If the court used history and tradition in those cases, they would have never been decided. As we know, in Perez, blacks could marry whites, whites could marry blacks. And if the court looked at history and tradition, then the cases would have, that case, Perez, would have been decided differently, as well as 20 years later in Loving. And so I think history and tradition is important for the court's analysis, but I think in Perez, the court ruled that it is not alone a basis to uphold the statute.
Do you agree with Mr. Morocco that the rights and responsibilities of domestic partners and marriage partners are substantially the same?
I believe in terms of tangible benefits, yes, Justice Chin, it's similar. However, we're not really analyzing the domestic partnership laws here.
And how does that similarity affect the analysis when we talk about people versus Perez versus Sharp? In other words, the disparate treatment based on race and the disparate treatment based upon sexual orientation, does the fact that the legislature has made substantial advances in making the domestic partner and the marriage partner substantially the same?
Okay, I'm not really clear on your question, but I think...
How does the fact that the legislature has come a long ways in making the relationships equal affect the analysis under Perez versus Sharp?
Okay, I think...
In other words, is there still a disparate treatment?
I think there is, Your Honor. I think that the domestic partnership laws are like placing your foot in the door. It's not complete. It makes people in California, individuals, feel inferior to other people. It goes back to Brown versus Board of Education, where they had separate facilities for blacks and whites, and how African-American children felt when they knew that their white counterparts were able to have different educational facilities than them, and they felt less than their counterparts.
Well, but Brown and its wonderful progeny are based on the post-Civil War amendments to the Constitution, are they not?
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So there is a constitutional basis explicit in the document that drives that outcome, regardless of what the public in their Jim Crow laws and all the rest of the terrible history of discrimination in this country would have counseled. There was a constitutional basis to say, you people don't get to have it both ways. We say everybody has to, no one can be discriminated against on the basis of race. I am looking, Mr. McCoy, for a similar constitutional basis for the outcome you urge.
Okay, well, Your Honor, I think we have to look at the policy that the state has in promoting or advancing our system so that we won't discriminate against a group of people. And I think here, because the statutes discriminate against gays and lesbians now, and we know about that, and the policy of the state is to protect people who are gay and lesbian, then that makes this court, puts this court in a position to rectify any kind of discrimination that is within the statutes. And I guess what I'm saying is the state has a policy of protecting its individual citizens, and gays and lesbians are a part of this society.
So we should recognize their status as a protected class?
I think we should.
And do we need to do that to get to the outcome you urge?
No, Your Honor, because I think the fundamental issue is whether there is a fundamental right to marry in this state. And so if it's a fundamental right, then of course the court has to use the strict scrutiny test. And I think what the Court of Appeals did that was wrong, and I think what they did was actually they took the safe road in saying, well, we're defining a right that's different. If they define marriage as a fundamental right, then strict scrutiny would have applied and the statutes would be stricken down.
So depending on how you define marriage.
Depending on how you define marriage. And I think, the issue came up in 1977, frankly, when California enacted this legislation saying that marriage is between a man and a woman. Before that time, it was kind of ambiguous in California, although the common meaning was there. But I think that our position today is that we're not redefining marriage. We don't have any problems with heterosexual couples versus homosexual couples. This is not a battle between homosexuals and heterosexuals. This is a matter of right, of privacy, a right of expression.
Well, it can't be a matter of privacy. We're talking about we're talking about the antithesis of privacy. We are talking about a public statement and a public acceptance of this status. That's the whole engine that's driving the train of the litigation.
Your Honor, I think that's partly true. I think we are talking about the state sanctioning marriages for all citizens. But I also think we're talking about privacy. I think we're talking about what individuals are doing within the privacy of their own homes, who they associate with, who they love, how they bring up their family, how they construct their family unit.
All of those would be subsumed under the domestic partnership laws.
Well, but not reckon. Well, if this,
just define differently, and it really does come down to how we define this institution.
I think the institution has already been defined.
Let me ask you this, because I think this goes to what's been underlying your argument for the last few moments. I think we can look at Lawrence v. Texas, a U.S. Supreme Court decision from 2003, that in invalidating its prior decision in the Bowers case, said that Bowers had erred in narrowly characterizing the constitutional right to be invoked in that case as the right to engage in intimate homosexual conduct. What the court in Lawrence did instead was to determine that the constitutional right at issue really should be understood in a broader and more neutral fashion so as to encompass the constitutional rights that are intended to be protected. So it does, I think, as my colleague has suggested, depend a lot on how you define the right, but the recognition by the U.S. Supreme Court in Lawrence would seem to indicate by analogy that you don't look at what we have before us here as the right to marry a person of the opposite sex, but rather as part of a right to marry. That's really, and see whether this is encompassed in it or not.
That seems to be the lesson that the U.S. Supreme Court was trying to convey in Lawrence when it reflected on its prior decision in Powers, which it overruled. And I'd like your thoughts on that.
Well, I think the Lawrence case was specific. It did, of course, did not deal with same-sex marriages. It dealt with a specific act.
We're talking about approach, though, whether you approach the right generally or generically, as the U.S. Supreme Court seemed to say you should. In other words, here is a right to marry, by analogy, as opposed to the right to engage in homosexual behavior, which is what was involved in Lawrence and Bowers. And by analogy, if we followed the Bowers rationale, that would be the right to marry a person of the opposite sex as opposed to the right to marry, whether that's encompassed. I don't know if you understand the distinction I'm suggesting may be drawn by those cases or not.
I'm not certainly sure that I understand your question, but I think what you're saying is whether there was some constitutional right that was asserted in Bowers that's comparable to what we're talking here. And I think that in Lawrence, the issue was whether there was a liberty interest that was being violated by criminalizing sodomy. And I think in that case, the court laid out certain things relating to liberty, like the freedom of expression, the freedom to have intimacy with the person of your own choosing without government intervention. So I think the court was actually making ground for where we are today, because I think that choosing your life partner is personal and it's an intimate freedom of expression. It's part of our human experience.
Well, doesn't Justice Scalia make that very point in Lawrence? Doesn't Justice Scalia make that very point in Lawrence?
I think that's correct.
Doesn't that go to whether we're dealing with the creation of a new right or just interpreting an existing right and its application?
I totally agree with you.
I think that's what both Justice Moreno and I are trying to get at.
I think that's correct, and I think that the right here is the fundamental right to marry. And
Mr. McCoy,
never been anything else.
You did establish that you think the right is the fundamental right to marry, not the parsed out right to marry a person of the opposite sex. Well, in your case, you'd be arguing a person of the same sex. So that was what the discussion was about. I want to move on. You touched on something that has not been raised here before, but was raised in the briefs, and maybe opposing counsel will bring it up. You said this is not a war between or a conflict between homosexual couples and heterosexual couples. This is strictly about the rights and the right of privacy and equal protection of homosexual couples. Would you address the argument that was made in the briefs, I don't know if it will be made this morning, that recognizing this right on behalf of persons of certain sexual orientation will diminish and undermine the long understood sanctity and tradition of heterosexual marriage? In other words, there is a point of view that there would be a conflict.
You may respond. Your time has otherwise expired, but you may respond to Justice Wintergard's question.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice Wintergard, I guess what I would do is I would take a look at the Massachusetts community and see that the walls aren't falling in, like I think one of my colleagues have said, that there is no deinstitutionalizing of what our common meaning, or the common meaning has been of marriage, and that. We're not diminishing the fact that heterosexual couples can't go ahead and get married and have children and have a family life and enjoy the human experiences that they still now share. We're just saying that this human experience should be extended to everyone, to all citizens, certainly in California at this point, because we think that our institution itself has progressed, and the law should be flexible in that regard. So I guess my short response should be Massachusetts hasn't fallen in. They have the individual rights to marry there, and I think we should learn from that, and I think that's my response.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCoy. We'll hear now from Mr. Krueger.
may take a moment if you wish. Things quiet down here.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court.
Mr. Krueger.
quite pleased. Now listen to the question.
Yes, I'd like to get my question in. It's a threshold inquiry, and that's why I wanted to get it in before you get involved into all these other issues. Whom do you represent in this proceeding?
The State of California and the Attorney General.
The reason I'm asking that question is this. Ordinarily, generally, the State Attorney General represents the governor of the State of California in a case where the governor's interests are implicated. As I understand this proceeding, or assuming that my recollection of what has gone on is correct, initially, you did represent the governor. Then, time went on, and the governor decided to hire his own attorney. So I wonder if you would be kind enough to explain, certainly for my puzzlement, as to why, in this case, there was a need to have the governor's interests represented not by the State Attorney General of California, but by a separate attorney. Are there, I will make it easier, are there differences between the two positions?
No, Your Honor, I do not believe there are significant differences between the two positions.
So it would be incorrect to say that there is a difference of opinion on the test that is to be applied here. I gather that you take the view that it is intermediate scrutiny. And is there a difference of opinion on the issue of immutability?
No, Your Honor, we did advocate in our brief that rational basis applies according to your precedents and applies here. What we said about intermediate scrutiny was that unlike the position that the petitioners are arguing, if the court does not believe rational basis is appropriate, there are other options rather than going to the other extreme, which is strict scrutiny. The governor's office's brief does not address intermediate scrutiny. Yes, it does not. But that does not mean that we're advocating a different position.
All right. Next inquiry, still threshold inquiry. This is one side of the issue. There is the other side of the issue. That side of the issue, which is to my left, to your right, the side there agrees on the basic arguments. Looking at your side, looking at the briefs, at a glance, I notice that there is a difference between the governmental entities and, as I will refer to the others as the private entities. One argument on the private side has been an argument pertaining to procreation or the begetting of children, and I notice that the government entities do not touch that particular issue. There are also other differences between the government entities and the private entities, and I think substantial differences in defending the status quo of the current marriage laws. And as I was going through the various differences between the government entities and the private entities, I thought, well, perhaps I should just pose to you the question. Does the very fact that there is considerable difference, or that there are considerable differences between the government entities and the private entities who are on the same side of the issue, does that very fact show or tend to show a weakness in the overall strength of the argument?
No, I don't think, Your Honor, that you can just suggest that because there are differences in sort of rational basis that are identified between the private entities on the one hand and the governor and the attorney general on the other hand, that somehow there is a weakness. The Of course, there's also this issue with the private entities about standing, which, you know, even this paper, but that's aside. We don't address that. But the fact that, you know, the rational basis test is any conceivable rational basis test, and any conceivable rational basis. Now, the state does not, the Attorney General doesn't have a monopoly on identifying rational bases. It's any conceivable rational bases, or other state interests. It's different courts around the country have upheld marriage laws that limited marriage to the union of a man and a woman, and they have also used different rationales at times, but they, except for Massachusetts and Hawaii, but it got reversed by a constitutional amendment, except for those examples, they're all reaching the same conclusion, if sometimes by different reasons.
A lot of those have been by a one vote margin, haven't they? I know sometimes there's reference, and there has been in some of the briefs, but I believe that people in the petitioner's position in the present proceeding were, I think, on the losing side of a 4-3 decision in Maryland, in New Jersey also a 4-3 decision, 5-4 decision in the state of Washington, and I think one other jurisdiction, maybe New York, was only 4 out of the 7 justices for the position that you espouse. So I just mentioned that because there's been sort of a tendency to say, oh, well, all of the cases have gone the other way, but
certainly not always by a very clear-cut majority.
I think basically all of them have been one-vote majorities. Almost all, like
Mr. Kruger,
hasn't been.
What is your position about the rational basis for the legislation we're talking about? Why is there a rational basis for differentiating?
There is a rational basis for the state to adhere to the common and traditional definition of marriage, which has been put into our its existence since our common law. It was put into our code more explicitly in the 70s. It was affirmed as a limitation on marriage by Prop 22, while at the same time providing all the rights and benefits that are associated with marriage to registered domestic partners. And previously there was a question, what is the definition of registered domestic partner? And the response was something like a functional nothing. The actual definition is in Family Code 297A. Domestic partners are two adults who have chosen to share one another's lives in an intimate and committed relationship of mutual caring. We submit that when the state is acting so aggressively to protect the rights and to protect the lives of domestic partners and to enhance their families, it is not irrational to maintain a definition of marriage which has endured the test of time, which really goes back. It predates our state, it predates our nation.
So you rely heavily on tradition. And in this particular case, yes, you would want the court to hang on to tradition. But as has been pointed out earlier from the bench, and taking a look at Perez versus Sharp itself, there was a long-standing tradition of not allowing persons of different races to marry. Yet, that long-standing tradition was struck down. And as I mentioned earlier, there has been a long-standing tradition of treating a wife like the property of her husband. That long tradition was struck down. And in more recent times, women couldn't become police officers and firefighters. And it was argued that it was a long-standing tradition that these occupations were filled only by firemen and policemen. And the arguments, as they were made back then, turned to dictionary definitions, where the dictionary talked about policemen and firemen. And you may recall that the women, in response, argued that the real issue was whether there was anything inherent in these particular occupations that justified a gender-based exclusion. What about the argument that isn't the issue here similar to these cases that I have articulated to you, where there have been long-standing traditions of blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera?
Your Honor, Perez and Loving involved invidious racial discrimination that got strict scrutiny. They involved putting racial discrimination onto marriage. There had been interracial marriage through history, but it had been put on marriage in our codes to and for nothing but the purpose of maintaining white supremacy.
And is it your position that we do not have that in this case?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And in fact, didn't the Domestic Partner Act explicitly state that domestic partners have the same rights, protections, benefits, and are subject to the same responsibilities, obligations, and duties under the law as granted to spouses?
Yes, Your Honor. It's our
In that regard, Mr. Kruger, you may recall the arguments by, I think, Ms. Stewart at the outset, where in response to a question from the court, Ms. Stewart pointed out, at least I think she did, that there is a significant difference between marriage and domestic partnership. And I think Ms. Stewart may have pointed out at that time that unlike marriage, a domestic partnership does not bestow title, status, or stature of marriage. And one could add that, this is an argument to which I would like your response, that implies, when I say that, I mean domestic partnership, that the domestic partnership status implies a lesser status. And consistent with that lesser status, so the argument goes, the state has made it easier to establish and terminate a domestic partnership in contrast to marriage, where it's much harder to get out of a marriage. Your response?
Well, yes, Your Honor. There are differences, which we have listed in, you know, which were listed in the supplemental briefing, between procedural differences between marriage and domestic partnership, getting in versus getting out. They're not all negative, by the way. Some might think that being able to stipulate with your partner to a non-judicial termination might be an advantage. Some of them, there's sort of a universal argument by the plaintiffs that every difference is negative, but some of the differences are just if you founded a parallel institution, you'd have some differences. But significantly, none of the differences that were identified by petitioners went to the fundamental right to marriage that could not be taken away without a compelling state interest.
Well, do any of the differences cause you to have any comment on a document that we were asked just last week to take judicial notice of, and we issued an order granting judicial notice of it, and that is the New Jersey Civil Union Review Commission that was established by law to compare the effects of civil unions as enacted in that state in response to a Supreme Court of New Jersey decision and the institution of marriage. Do you have any comment? Because that report seems to be rather negative in terms of the quality of the ramifications of a civil union or arguably domestic partnership as compared to a marriage.
Multiple responses, Your Honor. First, the fact that the court has taken judicial notice of that report does not mean that it accepts the truth of the content in the report. Obviously, that's all hearsay from a commission of the legislature in New Jersey, and under your Mangini versus R.J. Reynolds decision in 1994, you don't take judicial notice of the facts, the truth of those facts. But I think that report actually well illustrates our point, which is that the legislative process, and that was a legislative and gubernatorially appointed commission in New Jersey, is working it out. Now, some might look at that report and say it was kind of a rush to judgment because they adopted civil unions, and on the one-year anniversary of civil unions, they already released this report saying they didn't work. They were, you know, I think realistically, one must take a, give society time to adjust, and there are things that, need to be considered and worked out, sometimes by the courts, sometimes by legislative tweaking. We've seen at least a half a dozen bills expanding domestic partnership law since the inception in 1999. They've marched steadily along. And I think reports like the New Jersey report show that the legislative process is a good place for that kind of policy-making decision.
But in this case, the legislature has twice voted to redefine marriage to include same-sex couples, and it was the governor who twice vetoed the legislation, and yet you're arguing to this court that it's improper for this court to get into a process that is best left to the legislature. The matter was submitted to the legislature. The legislature, as I just pointed out, has acted twice, and twice, I mean, in favor of what the opposite sex has been arguing, and twice the governor has vetoed it. So what happens to your argument that we should really wait until the legislature steps in for the third time?
Well, what we're saying here is that the legislature is actively engaged in responding to these issues. Just with regard to the political powerlessness prong of the suspect classification theory, the U.S. Supreme Court in the City of Cleburne said it isn't political powerlessness because you can't control the legislature. No interest or factional group in society can control the legislature all the time. Doesn't mean that you apply strict scrutiny here because having gotten 95% of one's agenda through the legislature in the last so many years, you can't get the last piece. It's also not necessarily, history tells us that, if you look at it from even from the other side's perspective, the 1950s, civil rights laws do evolve. The 1957 civil rights, U.S. civil rights law was ultimately followed by the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. I mean,
it's deference, to legislative process or the will of the voters. A legitimate governmental interest for purposes of equal protection analysis.
Yes, Your Honor. We submit that it is a legitimate interest because it's not just deference to a legislative line the legislature drew. This is a definition of marriage which has proven, durable through the test of time, that predates our state and our nation. It was in our common law. It's been adopted into our law. It's not just any line that was drawn here. And there is continuing effort to address it, to address the interests that are being represented by
people.
Well, the interests that you just mentioned, couldn't one use that same language with regard to racial discrimination, the exact words that you
said? What distinguishes this case from Perez and Loving, where there was marriage and there was nothing, and there was a racial discrimination that had been put on marriage for no reason other than white supremacy. Here, plaintiffs talk about domestic partnership as if it were, the segregated schoolhouse.
But here it seems that the statutory scheme does define marriage by whom it excludes, to the extent of saying shall be only between a man and a woman. So that's the argument the other side is making. So I'd like you to address that.
Well, it does define marriage as the union of a man and woman, because that's been the understanding of what marriage is in our society.
That was true in terms of the miscegenation law that preceded the adoption of the U.S. Constitution and started off California as a new state, too. That was part of the tradition, wasn't it? That's their point. So I'd like you to, come to grips with, how you deal with that.
Well, you might contrast the marriage laws that reflect a certain definition of marriage and, say, the statute at issue in Perez. The statute at issue in Perez prohibited whites and non-whites from marrying. It didn't prevent other non-whites from marrying each other because it was specifically only for the invidious purpose of racial discrimination. Here, yes, it is a distinction that same-sex couples aren't, aren't allowed to, to marry under our laws, but that is not the same kind of exclusion in a statute.
Counsel, are you saying that separate is equal here?
I'm saying these are parallel institutions.
So is that separate is equal?
Here, there is equality.
And what distinguishes this from Perez is that there's no animus against gays and lesbians?
Well, there's no animus, that there's no...
Well, that didn't motivate the creation of the law?
It's not just that there's a lack of animus, because certainly in its very original conception, it couldn't have been animus. The question was asked of one of the petitioners' counsel, when did the right to marriage, when was a same-sex marriage, when did it first take, originate? And,
well, didn't it originate? Intimate relationships between same-sex couples have been around for centuries, if not thousands of years. Is that correct? Does anyone dispute that?
It's right, but it's pretty plain that that when the marriage laws were created, when they were taken into our culture, there was, the 1849 Constitution says only marriage shall be provided without respect to the Tanzanian religion. It wasn't. That was the big thing on their mind. They knew what marriage was.
Well, Mr. Kruger, let me ask you something. You opened your argument by saying that there is a rational basis for the state's choice to reserve the designation marriage to heterosexual couples. And the rational basis that I recall you said was the state has an interest in maintaining the common traditional understanding of marriage. And I'd like you to answer this question. Is that end of sentence, or is there some value to maintaining the common traditional understanding of marriage? Does it lead to, I ask you to fill in the blank, but to the stability of society, or consistent with the will of the people, or are you just saying the interest in maintaining the common understanding? Is there more?
Well, it is, of course, consistent with the will of the people under Prop 22.
But is this part of your argument, or is your argument simply it's tradition? And that's our rational basis.
It is. Part of the rational basis is certainly that the people have moved to put that limitation on marriage, not just themselves through the initiative, but through their elected representatives.
Now, the limitation was a result of the voter initiative. Isn't that correct? To the extent that 308.5 of the Family Code limits marriage to opposite-sex couples, consistent with the federal law, to the extent that the people pass that initiative, do you agree with the earlier exchange with opposing counsel that if the legislature disagreed with the judgment of the people, that under the state constitution they were without power to change that definition?
People were without the power?
The legislature would not. In other words, let's say that the governor did sign the legislation that would have changed the definition of marriage as adopted by the people in the initiative process. That would be an unconstitutional act, would it not be?
Well,
under the state constitution.
It is our position you don't have to decide that issue here, but I understand you want an answer, and the answer is that Prop 22 applies to both in-state and out-of-state marriages, and so yes, Proposition 22 would violate Article 2, Section 10 of the Constitution.
So why is it that the drafters of the state constitution would permit the people by the initiative process to quite easily invalidate a statute passed by the legislature, but if the opposite situation arose, where the people adopt a statute, the legislature is precluded from disapproving that statute. Does that seem to indicate that the people have a more supreme power over the legislature in adopting legislation?
Yes, I think the Constitution provides that the legislative power is reserved to the people and sort of allowed to the legislature. The people have the superior legislative power. It is an intent to protect the, so that when the people pass an initiative, it can't just be undone the next day by a bill.
Given your reliance. If an initiative is in violation of the Constitution, it obviously can be invalidated.
If an initiative that's a statute
yes.
is in violation of the Constitution, yes, it can be invalidated.
Now, well, we're talking about here, in part at least, our domestic partnership acts that were adopted by the legislature after the people defined marriage as involving opposite sex couples, and the argument that by so doing the legislature has indirectly invalidated the initiative passed by the people.
No, Your Honor, we don't agree that. If your question is whether the Domestic Partnership Act conflicts with Prop 22, we don't agree. We think the third DCA in the Knight case got it correct.
The other side is arguing, though, that because of the equality developed through the Domestic Partnership Act, that there's no rational basis to deny same-sex couples the title of marriage. That is at least part of the argument. And my question to you is, to the extent that those statutory laws adopted by the legislature came after the definition adopted by the people, does that mean that the legislature can indirectly invalidate the definition as adopted by the people?
No, Your Honor. The legislature can't indirectly.
I mean, do you place any?
Do what it couldn't do.
Do you place any weight at all on the fact that what is being challenged here is the definition adopted by the people as opposed to a definition adopted by the legislature?
Yes.
Well, then let me ask you, given that reliance, whether you agree or disagree with the following statement by Chief Justice Berger in a 1981 case, Citizens Against Rent Control versus Berkeley. Quote, it is irrelevant that the voters, rather than a legislative body, enacted this law because the voters may no more violate the Constitution by enacting a ballot measure than a legislative body may do by enacting legislation. Do you agree with that statement or do you question it?
Well, I would say that unlike what must have been the case, and that's a statement, I mean, best to say it. We're not saying that the people have absolutely made the marriage laws constitutional or something, or the legislature has. What we're saying is it is a rational basis. Equal protection, of course, is a concept of review of statutes. We're not saying that the people in Prop 22 or the legislature in domestic partnership kind of walled off, as would be suggested in Chief Justice Berger's quote, the issue from any consideration by the court. In fact, we supported petitions for review in this court. We're not arguing against.
No, but you seem to be treating, if not sacrosanct, enactments by the initiative process somehow. On a level that is subject to lesser review by a court. And I think Chief Justice Berger's, quotation from his opinion there
would call that into question. And I would ask you, too, I ask counsel, Mr. McCoy, about Mulkey versus Reitman. Are you familiar with that
Yes.
case where the people passed a initiative measure to overrule the fair housing requirements, and this court had to invalidate the initiative because of that running afoul of constitutional principles?
And in Mulkey versus Reitman, I understand that this court invalidated based on the federal constitution.
That's correct.
And that it was later affirmed after the Supreme Court granted cert on the federal constitution
Yes.
question. Here, the plaintiffs, there's some distinction to be made because the plaintiffs are assuredly bringing their case only under the California constitution.
Well, are you saying that this court has a lesser power of review with regard to a claim of state constitutional error than it does with regard to a claim of federal constitutional error? Because I'm not aware of any such distinction.
No, Your Honor, but where I was going with what I was saying was, as I recall from former counsel, prior counsel's comments, there seemed to be some suggestion that, well, if we put something in the California Constitution and then there's equal protection in the California Constitution, that a specific provision of the California Constitution would not control over a general principle of the California Constitution. Of course, that's not the case here, but that seemed to be the distinction that was being referenced in the last discussion of the Mulkey case. Of course, this court has as much authority to review,
authority and responsibility. Isn't that correct?
Well, yes, I would assume this court is the primary determiner of what passes the California
Constitution. We don't reach out and get these cases. They come to us.
I'm sure there's no shortage.
Mr. Krueger, assuming that we agree that we have the duty and the responsibility to resolve this case, what if we were not to agree with you that rational basis scrutiny applies, but we were to come to the conclusion that it is strict scrutiny, just assuming for the moment, does the state have a compelling interest in leaving its definition of marriage to include only heterosexual couples?
Yes, it does, Your Honor. And the reason is that what we have here is a long-standing institution in our society, a building block of our society, marriage between a man and a woman. It is a highly important governmental interest, and yet when you look at the other side of a strict scrutiny analysis, narrowly tailored, when we've given the rights and benefits of marriage, and when gay men and lesbians have the family rights of autonomy as opposite sex couples do, it is narrowly tailored. The restriction here is literally kind of no broader than the interest it's protecting.
How would you distinguish the holding in the Lawrence case? Justice Scalia, who dissented in that case, said that the liberty protected by the benefits of... that Lawrence leaves no room to deny the benefits of marriage to homosexual couples exercising the liberty protected by the Constitution. Do you take that broader reading of Lawrence?
Well, I think when Justice Scalia was predicting that the Lawrence holding was going to lead to same-sex marriage, he was engaging in a bit of hyperbole. I don't,
but we're here,
for a moment, believe that if that case... I'm sorry.
We're here.
Yes, we're here, but Lawrence was getting to a fundamental rights analysis. Lawrence did not throw away all fundamental rights analysis. All prior analysis. It still looked at considerations like how prevalent were the sodomy laws, how many had been repealed. I mean, it said the traditions of the last 50 years are the most
really
relevant.
About the right of homosexuals to engage in sodomy, or about something else?
Yes, he was talking about that.
Oh, no, the case. Was the right asserted there about the right to engage in homosexual sodomy, or was it about the right to privacy and free association and so forth? A broader right, constitutional right.
Well, it was the Texas statute was directed to homosexual sodomy, but the constitutional issue was the broader right, yes.
Is that the same thing here?
No, how so?
Well, in terms of the definition of marriage, do we just look at the specific definition of marriage, or do we look at the attributes which are incorporated in the relationship of marriage?
Well, I think it would be a very different case if the attributes incorporated with in marriage were not being provided here, but they are.
Well, look, to get specific, because I asked the same question of opposing counsel, are we talking about a right to marry a person of the opposite sex or of the same sex, or are we talking about a right to marry and what's encompassed in that? And I think that's the analogy that both Justice Moreno and I, in the present questions and the earlier questions, were trying to draw out from other counsel as well with regard to the interplay of Lawrence and Bowers. Lawrence seems to have rejected the narrow definition of the right in question that the court engaged in Bowers. And I think the question here is, do we, as the High Court did in Lawrence, view the right globally or generically as opposed to in the narrow fashion that was applied and then later rejected in the Bowers case?
And Lawrence did not invalidate the Glucksberg analysis, which was adopted by this court in the Don D case, which is that you have to carefully decide what a fundamental right is, and that it's based, it's in a due process fundamental rights analysis, it looks back toward what is deeply rooted in our history and traditions and consistent with our views of ordered liberty.
But how you define the right can have a lot to do with how you come out in the end in your analysis, can't it?
It could, but I think as the Court of Appeal majority properly said here, one does not have to define a fundamental right in such a way as that it must absolutely be exercised by everyone. There is a definition of marriage in the family code. When plaintiffs come up here, they're saying marriage is the right of mutual caring. It's never been recognized by any of the right to marry cases that way. They've all the fundamental right to marry cases recognize marriage in the context of opposite sex couples. And that's because that is definitionally what marriage is and has been.
Finish up. I have one
It's follow-up. Not the same error made in Bowers, where in Bowers there was a generally applicable sodomy statute and the U.S. Supreme Court said, we're only going to consider this based as a fundamental right to homosexual sodomy because you happen to be gay. It's not that. Here, it's not defining the right by who's bringing it. The right has been defined, and it is, marriage is defined both constitutionally and statutorily as the union of opposite sex.
Other counsel in their briefs and in oral argument have said that the Attorney General concedes that sexual orientation is a suspect class, although there's some variation in that because you seem to add a fourth element of political powerlessness to the three traditional elements. Is that a correct characterization of your position? And if so, would you explain the political powerlessness aspect that you have added as a fourth element to the three traditionally recognized in that classification?
No, Your Honor, we don't concede that sexual orientation is a suspect class, and no, we have not added political powerlessness as an element to the analysis. What we did in our brief, and we've looked back, is what is the reason strict scrutiny applies? And if you go back to Caroline Products and the cases from the High Court coming forward, they look at, especially City of Cleburne, they look not just at whether it's a discrete insular minority involved, whether, you know, mutability, ability to contribute to society. They also look at political powerlessness, because that's the inquiry that is relevant to how strictly judges should be looking at laws.
How does that jibe with what's transpired with race and gender discrimination laws?
Well, race, you know, is in the history of the 14th Amendment, so it's somewhat in a special category. And also, of course, you know, the Caroline Products majority in footnote 4 was thinking, I think, about race, about discrete and insular minorities. this court in the Sailor Inn case said in 1971, let's look at the events. But it was looking at the analysis that had been applied by the U.S. Supreme Court and ticked off several, immutability and ability to contribute and discrimination, and said suspect classification should apply. But when the High Court came to that issue, they did not ultimately, even though this court was predicting the High Court's reasoning would lead it in that direction, it did not go in that direction.
Mr. Kruger, a moment earlier, I thought I heard you say that the definition of marriage as between a man and a woman has been recognized, we've heard many times traditionally, but I thought I heard you say both statutorily and constitutionally. Did I hear you say that? That it's been recognized constitutionally?
Yes, Your Honor.
Help me.
Well, I didn't mean that it was written in the Constitution. What I meant is that the fundamental right to marry cases, perhaps I used too much shorthand, the fundamental right to marry cases all are in the context of opposite-sex marriage, and they're all, when they're talking about their privacy rights, they're envisioning a male-female relationship.
Oh, well, I would never disagree with that that's how it's been envisioned, but I did pick up on the word it's been recognized constitutionally, and I thought that would help us quite a lot if it had been, but...
I overspoke. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Mr. Kruger, let me rephrase. All four attorneys on your side agree that under state law, there are no significant differences between marriage and a domestic partnership law. But whereas you and counsel for the governor take the view that married persons do not possess any substantive right that cannot at one point in time be taken away by the state, the private parties take a completely different view. They point out that the state constitution guarantees the right to enter into a legally recognized union between a man and a woman, direct the upbringing of children, manage and control property, and transfer property without reassessment. Thus, unlike you, unlike the attorney representing the governor, the private entities insist that the word marriage has independent constitutional significance and therefore, according to the private parties on your side, cannot be changed by state law. The problem I have is this. This goes back to my threshold inquiry when I asked you the first question when you started your argument. Here we have the same side defending the status quo, and yet on this particular issue as to what marriage entails, there are two completely divergent views. Now, could you offer some help as to how the court is going to pick and choose? Do we agree with you and the representative of the governor, or do we agree with the private parties that the state cannot ever, ever, ever take away any substantive right pertaining to marriage, because according to the private parties, that is enshrined in the state constitution? So how do we solve the dispute on the same side between the various entities?
I think, Your Honor, there has to be a clarification that what we're talking about here, the way we interpreted the court supplemental question, was what rights do married couples have by virtue of being married that can't be taken away without a compelling interest? We're not saying married people have no rights, but if you look very...
No, I think you misunderstood my question, or perhaps I'm misunderstanding your argument, but to clarify, you take the view that whatever substantive rights people in a married relationship have, the state the legislature can at any time take away any of those rights. In agreement there as to your view?
Yes.
All right. But completely different is the view of the private parties, who have argued that these rights that married couples have, and I articulated those rights earlier, are enshrined in the Constitution. And my question to you was, how would this court have to resolve the differences on the one side defending the marriage laws?
Okay. Your Honor, it is important. One way to resolve it is to look at what the petitioners, on the one hand, and the organizational respondents, not the governor or the AG, on the other hand, identify as the parts of the fundamental right to marry that can't be taken away.
Do we agree with you, or do we agree with the private party that the substantive rights can, at any pertaining to a marriage, can at any time be taken away by the state?
Depends on how you define what the fundamental rights to marriage are. When they identify rights that can't be taken away from married couples in response to your question, they talk about sexual intimacy, whether and when to have children, how to raise children, how to allocate responsibility within a relationship. And when they talk about those interests, those are interests that everybody has. Certainly, divorced people or people who never got married don't lack for the right to know how to raise, you know, to direct the raising of their own children. Certainly, while there might have been, some talk about, the Griswold case recognized a right to contraception for married couples, but 6 or 7 years later, the Eisenstadt case said it applied to everyone, married or single. So the way to resolve the issue is to look at the rights that they say are fundamental that inhere in the marriage relationship, and to recognize that while a lot of, 50 years ago or in the time when Ozzie and Harriet were on TV, those might have been rights that were absolutely reserved to married people. There was no, sex outside of marriage, and there was no procreation, or at least not legal. No contraception outside of marriage. It would be illegal in some states. Those kind of personal and autonomy interests are now provided by state law to everyone. After Lawrence, there could hardly be a claim that the government could prohibit anyone from sexual intimacy. Yet they list that as one of the important rights of marriage.
Mr. Krueger, can we go back to Ms. Stewart's first issue, and that is that there can be no equality without marriage. Agree or disagree?
I disagree, Your Honor.
Why?
Because we are giving equality in the rights and benefits that are provided. And because, yes, society is still understanding this issue. Yes, the New Jersey is putting out a report within 12 months of civil union statute. But there is some time, but it is not appropriate. And there's no real record here about the efficacy in our case, about the efficacy of our law, our domestic partnership law. It's premature to sort of rush ahead of the legislative process when that process is so thoroughly engaged.
There's one other thing I need clarification on before your time is up. You've spent your time here and in your brief too focusing very much on rational basis review. You suggest there might be an intermediate level of review, but you don't really come out and apply your position to what the court should do if it were to disagree with you and adopt strict scrutiny. And to the extent you rely on tradition and history and some other things that you've mentioned, those obviously carry much more weight in a rational basis review than they do in a strict scrutiny review of a suspect class. So I just would like you to, briefly address how your position would be phrased in that context of that heightened level of review, if that's what we determine is appropriate.
I think in that case, the state does have a compelling interest in maintaining a definition of marriage which has proven itself through time, which has been a building block of our society, which has which has been recognized by our legislature and by the people separately. And as I believe I said before in response, I think, to Justice Werdegar's question, it's no broader at this point than necessary. It is congruent with its with the restriction with breadth of it.
Federal definition adopted by Congress and signed into law by President Clinton have a bearing on that? In other words, when the people in California adopted the definition they did, and it paralleled the federal definition, does that have a bearing on either rational basis or strict scrutiny?
It has a bearing insofar as when we're looking at our history and traditions for the fundamental right to marry, we have to also look at federal law, and it doesn't recognize opposite sex of a same-sex marriage. It doesn't. Otherwise, I think it was referenced earlier. A question said, "Well, wouldn't it be rational under rational review to name marriage to have a domestic partnership? Because after all, the 1,000 federal rights aren't being provided, even if same-sex marriage were legalized." And I think it does inform that rational basis.
Thank you, Mr. Krueger. Your time is up.
Thank you.
Hear now from Mr. Heinemeier.
Good morning. Ken Minnemeyer here on behalf of the Governor of the State of California and the State Register of Vital Statistics. And I have a feeling that the court may have some questions for me, so
perhaps
we should start there.
I'll start. Let's assume that we agree with your side. You win. How should a domestic partner answer the following question? Are you married or are you single? Wouldn't the existing statutory scheme compel a domestic partner to disclose his or her sexual orientation in situations where they would prefer not to? Wouldn't that implicate the state constitutional privacy interests?
I don't think it does implicate the state privacy interest, because many of those disclosures would result in identification of the partner, for example, insurance purposes and otherwise, and so it does not implicate the privacy interest. Also, the institution of marriage and the institution of domestic partnerships are public institutions. And as public institutions, they're different from that. They do not implicate the right to privacy.
And is prohibiting marriage between different race couples is race discrimination? Why isn't prohibiting marriage between same-sex couples sex discrimination?
Well, certainly the statute is facially neutral in that respect. It says nothing about sexual orientation, and so in that regard, it's facially neutral. Also, as a matter of precedent, there's no precedent in California appellate courts, in federal courts, or in state Supreme Courts holding that sexual orientation is a suspect classification.
But doesn't that ignore the practical effect? I mean, obviously, people same sex are not going to marry people of the opposite sex if that's their view, even if it doesn't say that on the face of the statute.
Well, that may be true, but the issue for the court is what standard of review is the court going to apply in a sexual orientation, a suspect classification.
Well, your brief doesn't really discuss the factors, I believe, that go into whether something is or is not a suspect classification. So I wonder if you would address the three factors that the Court of Appeal discussed in its opinion, and perhaps this fourth element, whether it's a factor or not of political powerlessness that seems to have been discussed in this context.
Well, frankly, on that issue, Your Honor, we did not discuss it in our brief because we don't have anything to add to what the Court of Appeal said and what the Attorney General said.
Right. So you adopt the position of the Attorney General and of the Court of Appeal majority with regard to it's not being a suspect class.
Well, we're not adopting that position. We're simply saying we don't have anything to add to the analysis other than what's already been presented to the court.
Now, what have you argued either in your brief or would like to argue this morning that is different from the Attorney General's argument?
Well, the difference, the question was asked of Mr. Krueger whether there's a difference in our positions, and he said that there's not. And I think that's an accurate statement. The reason that we're here separately goes in part to the presentation. There was the suggestion in the Attorney General's brief that the court consider the possibility of adopting a new intermediate level of scrutiny, and from our standpoint, we take issue with that. There's certainly no basis in this court's jurisprudence to adopt a new third level of scrutiny.
So which level do you think we should use here, rational basis?
Well, we think rational basis applies because the statutes in question do not differentiate based on any suspect classification.
And either with respect to rational basis or the more stringent compelling interest, do your views differ from the Attorney General's as to how the state has either one of those bases, a rational basis or a compelling state interest? We've just heard what they are from the point of view of the Attorney General. Do you have anything to add?
Well, I think that I do, and perhaps what I should do is articulate what those interests are as we perceive them. Because the differences, there may be differences, albeit nuanced. The first interest that we perceive and advocate is that the state has an interest in the balance that's been struck by the legislative process, that is the balance between providing rights and benefits to same-sex couples and at the same time upholding and affirming the common understanding of marriage. So that's one interest that we've advocated. And then the second one is, as the court's questions have acknowledged, the institution of marriage is under a pretty robust debate in society. I think societal notions of what marriage is and what it should be are being challenged. And those issues raise significant policy and social questions. And our position is that those questions are best left for the legislative process to sort out and to determine, because of all of the various interests and voices that get brought to bear on those issues. So those are the interests that we articulate as the rational basis to uphold these statutes.
When you say leave it to the legislative process, do you agree with the comment I made earlier that to the extent that Family Code Section 308.5 would define marriages as between opposite sex couples that are made in California, that the legislature would not have the power, nor would the governor, to disapprove that definition?
Yes, we agree with that analysis.
So when you say you would leave it up to the legislative process, it might be somewhat more accurate to say you would leave it up to the democratic process.
Well, yes, that's certainly a component to it. But at the same time, within the legislative process, the legislature has been doing a vast number of things to confer all of the same rights, privileges, and benefits on same-sex couples as on married couples, and this court recognized this much in
the Cookie. That's certainly true, and that informs the debate, but the legislature has not redefined marriage in the way that the plaintiffs are seeking.
It most certainly has not.
And Prop 22 has defined it differently.
Which statute?
Proposition 22.
Yes.
You know, the initiative by the people?
Yes. And you're saying it has defined it differently than the petitioners advocate?
Yes.
Yes, definitely it does.
Right. So the definition of marriage, you are arguing, should be left up to the democratic process, informed in part by what the legislature does with regard to domestic partnerships.
Yes.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
Yes.
Please.
Rhetorical question.
Is it your view that same-sex couples wouldn't be as good at parenting as opposite-sex couples? The reason I'm asking is I'm trying to figure out the differences between the government entities and the private entities, and we'll hear from the private entities later and they can clarify whatever they need to clarify. But I thought that that was one argument implicit in the main argument that one of the private parties, I think Campaign for California Families, has made. So do you share that view?
Well, you've asked both a broad question and a narrow question, and I'll answer them both. Certainly no one holds a monopoly on articulating a rational basis to uphold a statute. The standard and the court's responsibility is to look for any conceivable rational basis. So we certainly do not claim a monopoly. With that said, though, in identifying what might be a rational basis, it would not be appropriate to find a rational basis in something that is somehow inconsistent with state policy as reflected in other statutes. So to come to the specific example you asked me about in terms of might one family setting be detrimental to children and that being a rational basis, state law recognizes that families take many forms and the state does not give preference to one form or another. So there are certain rationales that might be offered, which if the court finds inconsistent with state policy as articulated elsewhere and in other legislation or in other decisions of this court, should be rejected as a rationale.
I wonder if you could address the gender discrimination claim. The opposing party said that the gender claim somehow was inextricably intertwined with the sexual orientation claim. They were part of the same aspect. There was a relational situation. Could you address that?
I'd be happy to. In our view, the statutes do not differentiate based on gender at all. The statutes treat both genders equally. There's no preference given. There's no the statutes don't favor one gender or another. The bottom line is that for men and women equally, neither gender may marry somebody of the same sex. So quite simply, there is no differentiation based on gender, and for that reason, there's no gender discrimination.
Now, if we disagreed with you and we agreed that there was a gender discrimination claim, how would that interact with opposing counsel's argument that there's also a sexual orientation claim? That's what I was asking.
Well, with regard to sexual orientation, as we've said in the brief, the statute does not differentiate based on sexual orientation. So facially, it's neutral. And that statute traces its origins pretty much back to statehood. And so there's no reason to think that that statute and that definition was there because of any discriminatory animus. In addition to that, we share the observation that there's simply no precedent around the country except one or two isolated cases, I think in lower-level state appellate courts, for the proposition that sexual orientation is a suspect classification. So if this court were to reach it, you would certainly be the first state Supreme Court to do so around the country.
How do you define a suspect class?
Well, in terms of definition of suspect classification, as I say, that's addressed in the Court of Appeal decision. It's addressed in the Attorney General's brief, and we don't have anything to add to that discussion.
You or part of your side, or probably all of the attorneys on your side, have argued that the definition of marriage is a matter of social policy on which this court should defer to the legislature. Response?
Well, we most definitely agree with that. It's the legislative and the democratic processes have been at work here through
and I'm interrupting because you may be running out of time, so please forgive me. But in light of your answer, I am looking at Perez versus Sharp, and that same argument was made by the dissent, where the dissent by Justice Schenck, pertaining to the laws in issue at Perez, said, it will be shown that such laws have been in effect in this country since before our national independence and in this state. Since our first legislative session, the majority disagreed with that. Isn't it significant that that very argument on which you seek to rely on was rejected by the majority in Perez?
I think Perez versus Sharp provides very limited guidance for the court on the issues before you today for two reasons. First of all, that decision, the term marriage as it was used in that case has to be understood in the context of that case. In that case, as in Loving versus Texas, and other cases that talk about a fundamental right to marriage, all involved opposite-sex couples. So the term marriage was necessarily understood at that time as a union involving a man and a woman. Secondly, Perez versus...
Although the language was used, I'll just interject and may continue your answer. Marriage with the person of one's choice. That's language used in Perez.
That is the language, and that really ties into the second part of Perez, which is the concern about Perez was the very clear racial animus reflected in the legislation that was in question there. And that racial animus most definitely implicated the equal protection of, in that case, the federal constitution.
Is the implication of your comment that there's no animus against persons of different sexual orientation?
Well, the issue before the court is the validity of the statute which limits defines marriage as a union between a man and a woman. And that history, that definition, traces its roots back to the beginning of statehood. And there's no showing that that definition, when it was originally put into the statutes, was motivated by any animus.
What about the enactment of Proposition 22?
Well, certainly on its face, it's...
In the year 2000, right.
On its face, it doesn't speak to that issue.
But clearly, it wasn't just dealing in the abstract, well, it would be a nice thing to define what marriage is. It obviously was a reaction to the possibility of marriages by people of the same sex.
Well, there were 4.6 million Californians who voted in favor of that proposition, and it's probably fair to say that there were a good variety of views motivating that vote. So to try to read those minds isn't particularly helpful and I think relevant to this analysis. What's important is there a conceivable rational basis for 4.6 million Californians voting in favor of that? And what that proposition represents is the desire of the California electorate to preserve what has been the common understanding of marriage.
And if we disagree with your position about rational basis review, then your position would be the same, that this would survive close scrutiny of a suspect class.
That's correct. That would be our position. Now, the court did ask a question earlier about the importance of Lawrence versus Texas, and I guess I'd just like to speak to that momentarily.
You may do so, and then you have exceeded your time, but you may
thank
that
you.
Thought.
The reading of Lawrence versus Texas that I think is relevant to this case is in looking at substantive due process and the protection that provision gives for the liberty interest, the court was looking at how to define the liberty interest in that case. That case involved private conduct in private places, and that was the basis for that determination. What is also significant about that is Justice Kennedy in his majority opinion and Justice O'Connor in her concurring opinion both indicated that court's decision in Lawrence versus Texas should not be read as bearing somehow in terms of obligating the states to recognize same-sex marriage.
But isn't there a privacy interest inherent in marriage? The case law seems to indicate that.
Well, there's
not just talking about a public licensing function.
Well, there's a privacy interest in the relationships you maintain, but once you decide to take those relationships public and ask for the public licensing, that becomes that necessarily, by definition, I think, takes it out of the private realm and puts it into the public realm. There was comment earlier that marriage is kind of the antithesis of privacy because of that very public aspect of what marriage is.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Minimai.
Thank you.
We'll now hear from Mr. Levy.
May it please the court, my name is Glenn Levy. I'm here on behalf of Proposition 22 Legal Defense and Education Fund. Your Honors, I believe that Proposition 22 controls the public policy on marriage in California. Voter initiatives are the ultimate expression of democracy in California. The reservation of the initiative power to the people is based upon the idea that all power of the government ultimately resides in the people.
But isn't, as we certainly explored in earlier arguments with counsel, isn't the ultimate expression of the people's will the constitutions, both federal and state, that they have adopted and whereby they have placed limitations upon their own power and the power of their elected representatives? You don't dispute that proposition, do you?
I do not dispute that at all. But the people are the ultimate arbiters of public policy, either through their constitutional pronouncements or through their voter initiatives, either way.
Subject to judicial review.
Subject to judicial review, yes, sir.
But the extent of judicial review is to see whether or not a given initiative, in this example, can be harmonized with the Constitution as adopted by the people, or whether there is an irreconcilable conflict. Isn't that the scope of judicial review?
Yes, Your Honor. That is the scope of judicial review. What you have heard from the petitioners is that public policy changes in California require that marriage now be defined in a way that encompasses same-sex couples. Your Honor, in 2000, with the adoption of Proposition 22, the people decided that public policy does not require same-sex marriage. Public policy requires that marriage remain the institution of a man and a woman. Your Honors, one of the things that the petitioners seem to assume is that when someone argues that there should be a change in the law, the people have no power to say, no, there shouldn't be a change in the law. We want to preserve the law the way it is. Proposition 22 was the people saying, no, we don't think the law should change. We want to preserve it. That's consistent with the idea that the people are the ultimate arbiters of public policy.
Well, Mr. Levy, my question is, let's assume, it's not difficult to assume, that public policy is that marriage is between a man and a woman. Does this leave this court with no role to play? What is our role?
Your Honor, I don't believe that this court has a role in redefining the term marriage. I understand that the petitioners are saying what we want is the right to marry, but the right to marry, as defined in every decision by this court, every decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, and almost every decision by any other state court, is the union of a man and a woman. That's what it was in Perez. That's what it was in Loving.
So what is our role? My question is, what is the role of this court if the public policy, as you assert, as expressed by 4 million people, is that marriage is between a man and a woman? Do we have any role to play?
Your Honor, I would submit that at most this court could say that the marriage laws are unconstitutional. I don't think this court has the constitutional authority to rewrite the marriage laws to give the mandamus relief that the petitioners have asked for.
So at most we would have the right to say, if we were to come to that conclusion, that they denied equal protection, and then what if we were to come to that, you're saying we have no relief to give to the parties, or we would send it back to the legislature to redefine the institution?
I'm saying that it would be the court's role to send it back to the legislature to decide what the remedy is in that case.
So this court was wrong then, obviously, under that reasoning in 1946 when it invalidated the miscegenation laws. It overstepped. I guess that's the logical import of the point that you're making right now.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with that conclusion. In the Perez case, this court struck down the statute that prohibited interracial marriage. It did not redefine marriage. Marriage before Perez was a union of a man and a woman. Marriage after Perez was a union of a man and a woman. Striking down the miscegenation law allowed interracial couples to marry, but it did not change what marriage was.
Well, I think it probably boils down to a question of semantics, because if we heard from opposing counsel, they could apply the same argument here too, I suppose, that a restriction is being removed, a restriction is being held unconstitutional. But you would view it from the opposite perspective.
Well, Your Honor, I understand the arguments that the opposing counsel are making, but it is the anti-miscegenation laws were very different from today's marriage laws. Today's marriage laws recognize what has always existed throughout all of recorded history. Anti-miscegenation laws were a departure from the common law. The common law, before California became a state, allowed interracial marriage. This court in Pearson v. Pearson recognized a common law interracial marriage from Utah.
But we have materials before us that indicate before the U.S. Constitution was adopted, and I believe there's some reference to 1691, one of the columns of already miscegenation laws. So there's been a history. It wasn't a recent innovation to enact miscegenation laws. I think there were about 33 jurisdictions that had a long history of them by the time we came to the end of World War II and the court was about ready to take up Perez's case.
Yes, Your Honor, there was a long history associated with slavery in America that had marriage laws that prohibited interracial marriage because of that institution of slavery.
But slavery was over with, 80 years before Perez. And
yes, Your Honor.
These laws remained on the books.
Yes, Your Honor. It took a while for this court to recognize it, but this court was able to point to a point in time when the miscegenation laws became unconstitutional. That was 1868 with the passing of the 14th Amendment. That was when the anti-miscegenation laws became unconstitutional. It wasn't because of a passage of time with some changes of public policy. Those laws became unconstitutional when the equal protection of the laws were expressly given to African Americans, and it was made unconstitutional to discriminate on the basis of race. we cannot point to a constitutional provision in the California Constitution that was adopted specifically to give express protection to same-sex couples. One of the things, and I understand that the opposition says that gays and lesbians do not want to marry an opposite-sex person, but that kind of highlights the fact that it is not marriage that they want, because marriage is an opposite-sex relationship. But the law does not say gays and lesbians cannot marry. It says that marriage is a union of a man and a woman.
But aren't the problems similar, and haven't the gay and lesbian community members gone through very similar kinds of discrimination?
Your Honor, this court has been presented with a lot of argument about discrimination that gays and lesbians have experienced. But one major difference is that there was a constitutional provision expressly passed for race, and there has not been a constitutional provision expressly passed applying to same-sex couples. And you understand it, when the our opponents argue about marriage, they are talking about couples rather than just gays and lesbians, because it is not specifically gays and lesbians who are not allowed to marry. They are allowed to marry, but they are not allowed to form a same-sex couple and call it a marriage.
Before your time is up, I want to make sure that you have an opportunity to address one of the rationales for your position as expressed in the briefs, and I believe that's true, both of you and Mr. Staver, that one of the basic justifications, one of the basic state interests in limiting marriage to opposite-sex individuals is the need to further the policy of procreation, procreation of children and the rearing of children. And you care to address that?
Certainly, Your Honor. One of the ways that we hear argument about this issue is the petitioners talk about why people want to marry. I would submit that the issue is not why people want to marry, but why the state regulates marriage. The state has, this court, as early as 1850, was talking about the primary purpose of marriage being procreation and the raising of the children of the marriage.
Well, then should we have marriage laws that say, over here, that say you can't marry unless you are prepared to have children or capable of having children, or your marriage doesn't count until you do have children? I'm puzzled by this somewhat narrow definition of the reason the state gets involved. Certainly, that is a very important aspect of this institution, but it is not the sine qua non, is it?
What, Your Honor, we would submit that that is the primary reason that the state regulates this private relationship. The state does regulate a private relationship when it regulates marriage. It has a lot of regulations about marriage, and it does that primarily because when men and women come together in sexual relations, so often they have children.
Well, then, what about, as Justice Corrigan asks, about people who were incapable biologically or by, you know, age or fertility, who don't want children? Is it enough to say, well, because some people want to have children, that's the rationale for having this whole scheme of regulation in terms of who can marry whom?
But, Your Honor, the fundamental right to marry does include all opposite-sex couples. So the fact that some people may not want to have children or may not be able to is something that the state would not be able to ask ahead of time before.
If the policy is that important, then why is it that the state allows gay and lesbian couples to adopt children? And I saw a study in some of the material here that indicated that 32% of lesbian couples have children. So if the state has a strong policy, then why is it allowing
same-sex couples to adopt and raise children.
Your Honor, one of the questions that Mr. Krueger was asked is why are there such differences in the arguments between the state and the private parties? One of those reasons is that the state is far more concerned about protecting some of the public policies that exist than what some of the private parties are, because our position would be that if there are public policies that have developed that are inconsistent with Proposition 22 and that would lead to striking it down, then those policies would be the legislature indirectly invalidating Proposition 22.
So there's some public policies you like, and that is the limitation of marriage to opposite-sex couples, but some you don't like permitting gay and lesbian couples to adopt because you think that runs contrary to Proposition 22. Is that
actually, Your Honor, the point that I was not articulating very well is that this court needs to reconcile all of those public policies rather than just saying that there are other public policies that would strike down Proposition 22. And that's what the Court of Appeal did. It reconciled existing public policies with Proposition 22 and said that Proposition 22 was constitutional.
Mr. Levy, if, as you have argued to this court in response to questions from the bench, if procreation is, as you insist, a fundamental policy or fundamental purpose of marriage, then the next inquiry would be, should infertile individuals be prohibited from entering into a marriage relationship?
No, Your Honor. I would submit, as the Standhart opinion described in the Arizona Court of Appeals, that it would violate rights of privacy to even make that inquiry, that it would violate the fundamental right to marriage to tell infertile couples that they could not marry. The fundamental right to marriage is a federal constitutional right, and I don't think that the state could tell someone they cannot marry because they're infertile.
Counsel, I have a question. Just getting back to Black for a second, you seem to suggest that, getting back to Perez, rather, you seem to suggest that that case was premised upon the 14th Amendment and the prohibition of against discrimination against African Americans. But I want you to respond to this statement contained in the plurality opinion. The decisive question, however, is not whether races, each considered as a group, are equally treated. The right to marry is the right of individuals, not of racial groups. That seems to suggest to me that the decision is not simply based on the 14th Amendment and the prohibition of discrimination against African Americans.
Although your time is up, you may respond to Justice Moreno's question.
Thank you, sir. Your Honor, I believe that Perez also talked about the due process, liberty interest, which, again, was the fundamental right to marry, which is the union of a man and a woman.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Levy. We'll hear from Mr. Staver now.
May it please the Court, I'm Matt Staver, representing the Campaign for California Families. We request this Court to affirm the order below from the Court of Appeals and to uphold the marriage laws, including Proposition 22, that have universally recognized marriage as a union of one man and one woman. Marriage is important not because of all of the rights and benefits that are attributed to it, but all of the rights and benefits are attributed to it because marriage is important. Marriage transcends governments, political parties, and various regimes, and that's why it's important. And there are legitimate and even compelling reasons for this state to continue the traditional and universal understanding of marriage as the union of one man and one woman.
Okay, well, you have argued that the marriage laws don't discriminate because everyone can marry a person of the opposite sex, but not a person of the same sex. To put it differently, there can be no discrimination, under your view, if everyone is treated alike. Can't one make the exact same argument about a law that prohibits interracial marriage? What is the difference?
Because the difference is between interracial marriage, Perez, and Loving, is that the institution has always been the same thing, one man and one woman. And, Mr. Chief Justice, one of the things that you had mentioned earlier is that there have been different kinds of changes that have happened to marriage through time. That's true. But one thing that's remained consistent is the definition of marriage as one man and one woman. What happened in Lovin and Perez...
Although, I'll just interject. Not everybody agrees with that. There was one brief filed by a number of, I think, 100 or so religious organizations and individuals that, I guess, dispute the historical understanding, as most of us might believe, that marriage has traditionally and historically always been limited or is supported by groups only to the extent it involves opposite-sex couples. But certainly the predominant view, if not the exclusive view, has been, you know, what you have stated.
And certainly here in America and in this state and throughout the Union, that has been and remains the universal view. But going back to your question, Justice Kennard, that issue was whether or not is there something outside of that definition that is prohibiting you from entering into marriage. In that case, it was the color of one's skin. But it wasn't just the color of one's skin. It was the color between white and black, or Malays, or mulattoes. It wasn't just barring interracial marriage in general, but predominantly trying to use the institution of marriage because of its transcendent importance to promote a politically racist message and to put racism in the universal understanding and institution of marriage. The 14th Amendment, this court's decision in Perez as well, found that this institution of one man, one woman marriage was fundamental, and you can't use the color of someone's skin to prohibit them from entering into that particular union. And Justice Corrigan, as one you had mentioned about the democratic process, I think one of the questions that we have here to really address is what compelling reason from the constitutional perspective is there for this court to interfere in this democratic process that has had significant debate in this state since 1999, only about 8 or 9 years or so.
Well, what's the compelling reason to agree with you? What's the compelling reason to uphold Prop 22?
The compelling reason is that there is no constitutional basis for this court to strike down that universal definition and undermine the reasons, both rational and compelling reasons, for marriage. For example, to look at whether there's a fundamental right, as the petitioners argue, we disagree. In order to reach that question, you have to ask this: what is the right they're asking? It is not marriage in general. It is same-sex marriage in particular. Only until the last brief filed by the city has the city changed its nomenclature from marriage to same-sex marriage. But 4 years of litigation has been about same-sex marriage. We need to
find... What about Lawrence and its treatment of Bowers? You've heard some discussion about
that. Yes,
and that seems to suggest that the High Court, anyway, takes the generic global view of the right in question as opposed to saying... what was involved in Lawrence is the right to engage in homosexual acts as opposed to the freedom of association, privacy rights. By analogy, doesn't that authority, Lawrence and its treatment of Bowers, support the view of petitioners that what we must consider here is a right to marry as opposed to a creation of a new right, a right to marry a person of the same sex?
No, Your Honor, for several reasons. First of all, what we're looking at in Bowers and Lawrence is a generic application of a sodomy law that is not just applied to someone who is same sex, but also opposite sex. That's number one. Number two, that particular right is not rooted in history. Number three, they're not redefining something. They're looking at the activity, not who before the court at that moment in time is engaging in it, because another case could have been opposite-sex couples engaging in the same kind of sodomy type of activities at issue. So the court was right to define it as this intimate relationship, not just same-sex sodomy in this particular case. And what Lawrence clearly did in response to Justice Marina, sometimes Justice Scalia often uses hyperbole, and forgive me if he ever watches this, but that's what he did in that particular dissent. And indeed, what the majority, as Kennedy and O'Connor said in concurring, is that that case does not go to the next step. It does not apply to this public expression of marriage. It applies to the intimate, interpersonal, behind the scenes, in the privacy of your bedroom, sexual activity. Marriage is not just a private entity, as the petitioners suggest. They define it as some kind of amorphous love between two individuals that the state must put its imprimatur and seal of approval on and give it the name marriage. But marriage is more than just a private relationship. It has public consequences.
Mr. Staver, on the subject of the definition of marriage, in your brief, you have argued that defining marriage as the union between a man and a woman, according to your words in the brief, promotes the optimal environment for the rearing of children. Implicit in that argument is that is it your view that same-sex couples are not as good at parenting as opposite-sex couples?
Justice Kennard, we may all have different private views and opinions on that, and that is being debated right now here in the democratic process in this great state. But the legal issue is not necessary to get to whether or not that's an optimal environment. We don't have that much difference between the state and the governor, as you might have suggested. What we are not doing, we're not saying that their interests are invalid. We're saying that we would have those same kind of interests that they promote, plus the issue of procreation, plus the issue of the state has a legitimate rational basis where opposite-sex couples are going to occur, procreation is going to be an offset of that particular relationship.
What if you don't prevail on the rational basis review? Is your position the same if we were to adopt a strict scrutiny standard and give close scrutiny to the classification that tradition, the right of procreation, the need to protect it, and other aspects of your argument would equally survive close scrutiny?
Yes, Chief Justice George, it would, because not only are there rational and plausible and reasonable bases for a rational basis, but there's compelling reasons as well for marriage, not the least of which is integrating of the sexes, not segregating them in single-sex relationships, but integrating the sexes. And from that integration, the natural interest that societies always have is in the procreation of children and having children with the right to have biological parents. I think that would be something that the state would have a compelling interest in, to at least give children that right, so that procreation that does occur from opposite sex relationships, children would have some kind of financial protection, and that's why marriage is there to
protect. But you're not suggesting that the 32% of lesbian couples mentioned in that survey of a few years ago are per se unfit parents?
No, we're not. We're not saying that at all. It's not part of our argument. But we are saying that the state does have a compelling interest in what happens differently between opposite-sex relations versus same-sex relations is the offspring of children. That is inevitably a difference that no matter whether we have artificial or reproductive assistance, we can't get around. The state has a compelling interest to be able to channel that into responsible procreation, to channel that into having these children protected in a way that same-sex relations would not produce. Same-sex relations will not accidentally, unintentionally, in an unplanned fashion, produce children. But opposite-sex relations does have that as an incident of the natural relationship between a man and a woman.
Mr. Staver, in 2005, in Elisa B. versus Superior Court, this court said, no reason appears that a child's two parents cannot both be women. Do you have a problem with what this court said?
That is not part of our case, and that's not part of our reason for this court to uphold that particular, marriage law. It's a different situation as to
except
whether...
Except you have made certain policy arguments in your briefs pertaining to the optimal environment for rearing children is in the setting of an opposite couple relationship. And so I'm asking these questions, and you keep telling me, look, that's not before you.
Well, I think that there are certainly a number of studies that indicate that children do best when they are raised by their genetically biological mother and father. Not talking about mom and dad or two people of the same sex, but at least have that genetic affiliation.
You mean whether they're opposite sex or not? You mean adoptive parents are not as adept at raising children, even if they take a baby a few months old and adopt a baby, as are genetically
based parents?
There's significant research that this court does not have to delve into to decide that issue. That genetic relationship between mothers and fathers is an important factor.
No, I'm not eager to delve into it, but it seemed that you were making an assertion, and I wanted to make sure the accuracy of my understanding.
I'm just saying that there are legitimate and even compelling reasons why the state can choose to maintain the institution of marriage. Procreation, even accidental, is going to be a consequence of opposite sex relations. Genetic relationship, I think, is a clear interest that the state can have to promote that issue, and that's something that we should not delve into to stop that democratic debate that is happening here.
If we were to disagree with you, would you foresee adverse consequences? And if so, I would like you to state these adverse consequences.
To same-sex marriage?
If we were to disagree with you, that means we would agree with the challengers.
Oh, sure. I think that what you have right now in California is the marriage relationship for opposite-sex couples that is universally recognized and understood through centuries. And you have the domestic partnership, as Justice Chin mentioned, has given all the rights and benefits and privileges and responsibilities and obligations to same-sex couples. So within the policy system, you have these kinds of equalities that have developed within...
You're talking about equalities. My question to you asked, what adverse social consequences you would foresee if we were to disagree with your view?
I think it would undermine opposite-sex marriage in the same way that if you were to have, and this is just an illustration, to have one atom of sodium and one atom of chlorine creates salt. You can't change that name without having consequences. You can't simply redefine the definition of marriage to include what it's never included, same-sex relationships, and have it have the same beneficial impact that is underlining the reasons for the institution in the first place.
Mr. Staper, I'm finding that argument to be a little elusive. I'm trying to figure out how, if this court were to recognize marriage between two people of the same gender, that would undermine opposite gender marriages. I want to give you a chance to make your best argument on that topic.
Yes, Justice Corrigan, and that's not part of our argument in this briefing.
Well, okay, fine, but
state.
What's your response?
But in terms of it, what it would be is a redefinition of the institution itself, and so that it would no longer be what it's historically been as marriage, and I think it would lose its meaning. And as has been indicated, marriage is important because it transcends human societies, and we've recognized it for its building block importance. So I think that it would ultimately create a new system that is no longer recognizable as marriage. And what this state has done is create a balance between marriage and the Domestic Partnership Act in terms of the benefits and the rights and the privileges.
Would it deprive other people of their rights, opposite-sex couples, or denigrate their rights?
I think, well, you know, if the state were to take it away, that's one thing, because I think there's more fundamental constitutional issues.
Oh, I'm saying if a decision were to extend rights to same-sex couples that were presently possessed by opposite-sex couples, would that deprive the opposite-sex couples of any rights or degrade their rights?
I don't know if it would deprive them of their right. But I know, and this gets outside of the record, what's happened, for example, in some of the Netherlands is that once it has been redefined, the institution starts to further denigrate or disintegrate, and therefore less people of opposite sex enter into that relationship because it's no longer what it has historically been understood to mean.
So that you consider an adverse social consequence. I'm just getting back to the
I think that would be an adverse
and
social consequence.
What you just mentioned pertaining to the Netherlands, I presume that same response that you just gave would with equal force apply to countries such as Canada, Belgium, Spain, and South Africa, right?
Well, the Netherlands is the one that has more of the research. The South Africa is only recent, so we don't know the consequences of this. And I think this goes back to Justice Corrigan's question. Is there any constitutional reason for this court to stop this democratic debate and process that's been in effect here in California more so than any other state? The only way to do that is there an express constitutional provision for what the petitioners ask for? The answer to that is no. Then the next question is the category of sexual orientation
relevant? Is that something that is rooted in history as it relates to marriage? Is same-sex relationships rooted in history as it relates to marriage? And the answer to that, when you're looking at the due process right, is no. There is no express or either indirect reason for this court to interfere with this ongoing democratic process in
right,
absence
Mr.
of a
Staver.
Constitutional provision.
I'm afraid your time is up.
Thank you,
Mr. Staver. We now will hear rebuttal argument. First 5 minutes from Ms. Stewart and then 5 minutes from Mr. Minter.
Ms. Stewart, did Mr. Staver just make your argument for you? That this marriage that you want is really, really important, and the status and the intangibles. Did he just make his argument, make your argument for you?
It is an area on which we agree. We just disagree about the consequences, and I'll get to that in a minute. I want to go back to an issue that Justice Moreno raised a question about to correct something, and this is, I think, a product of the fact that in the trial court, the trial judge felt that he could decide the issues and did decide them on the basis of law, so the record isn't as well discussed as it might be. But there is evidence in the record on immutability, and it is the declaration of Mr. Herrick, or Dr. Herrick, rather, and the declaration of Dr. Galitzer-Levy, and I would just refer the court to those, and basically they show that same-sex sexual orientation has occurred across time and across cultures, every place it has been studied, and that there's no credible studies that suggest that it can successfully be changed and that it is deeply harmful to try to change it. And there's a brief, an amicus brief on that topic by the American Psychological Association, if I recall correctly.
Ms. Stewart, I have two questions related to the argument has brought out why Perez case, the case that said you can't bar marriage between persons of different races, is not applicable here. One argument was made that the anti-miscegenation laws departed from the common law, whereas the common law always, I'm quoting, recognized marriage as between a man and a woman. And the second argument why Perez wouldn't apply is that here there is domestic partnership opportunity, whereas in the Perez case and the banning of interracial marriage, there was no alternative. Would you respond to those two arguments?
Well, I think the second claim that it's different suggests that that the Perez decision would have been decided differently if domestic partnership had been offered, or say we called it transracial unions instead of marriage. And I just don't think the case would have come out differently. I think the court would have recognized that marriage is a meaningful institution. On the first point, the common law doesn't dictate what the Constitution requires. It can be relevant, but the common law of marriage was the common law I was talking about earlier, about coverture. And again, the state has...
But with respect to the what we're focusing on, marriage is defined as between a man and a woman. And
yes.
The argument was made that in the common law that was always the case, and it was embraced implicitly in our Constitution.
It's not embraced in our Constitution, Your Honor. The Constitution doesn't purport to describe or define marriage. But it certainly was true that the common law at the time the Constitution was created defined marriage that way. But again, I don't think that holds the court back. You know, let me just tell you a story that I heard about the Brown case, Brown versus Board of Education. The court there was... it asked for supplemental briefing on the issue of whether the framers of the 14th Amendment understood segregation to be legal. And it turned out that the framers of the 14th Amendment had adopted legislation around the same time or earlier, but that was on the books, that segregated the District of Columbia schools. And the court in Brown didn't say that, well, we have to look at the 14th Amendment and put ourselves in the mind of the framers and how they would look at segregation in the public schools today. We have to look at what we know today and what we understand today.
Ms. Stewart, if the California legislature were to enact a law providing that mixed race couples could not marry, but they could register as domestic partners, do you perceive a violation of the state constitution?
I think this court would strike it down in a heartbeat, Your Honor.
Do you apply the same reasoning to the issue before this court, marriage between same-sex couples?
I think the analysis is the same, Your Honor. I can't predict what the court will say about it.
All right. Next inquiry. If we were to agree with you, what adverse consequences, if any, do you perceive would follow from this court's decision? You may recall I asked that question of the opposing side, and the answer, I think, singled out the country of the Netherlands, and you may remember the rest of the answer there. But I would like to hear from you. If we were to agree with you, are there any adverse consequences that would follow from the decision?
I don't believe there are, Your Honor, and I think that the fear of change often has been the basis for arguing that the court shouldn't make constitutional decisions that extend traditions to groups that have historically been excluded from them, but that history has told us that when it has done so, it hasn't had horrible consequences. You know, it's interesting. The state in this case keeps saying that there's no constitutional significance to the status and title of marriage, and that it can therefore deny marriage to lesbians and gay men without harm. But the allies, as you've mentioned, hold a strikingly different view. They insist that the meaning, that marriage has hugely important meaning, and that it can't be denied to heterosexuals, but that lesbians and gay men don't deserve that meaning, and they don't need that honor.
What is your response to the argument of the opposing side in response to a question from the bench, where it was pointed out that the brief of that particular entity pointed out that the relationship of an opposite sex couple joined in marriage provides the optimum environment for rearing children?
I think
Your time is up, you may respond to Justice Kennedy.
If that were our state's policy, you would expect that in the areas of the law where the state most directly regulates who can be a parent, namely the foster parenting laws and the adoption laws, that there would be a preference of that sort expressed. And not only is there no such preference, but the law prohibits discrimination in those arenas. And this court has held, or I believe actually it's the courts of appeal that have held, that the custody decisions also cannot be made based on sexual orientation. So there's no support for that notion. It's inconsistent with California
law. Nor was
law.
That argument made in support of Prop 22, was it?
I'm not sure I follow you, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
The right of raising children, having children, that argument was not made in support of Prop 22, was it?
Not made by my opponents?
Not made by the proponents of Prop
22. Oh, that's correct, Your Honor. The proponents of Proposition 22 argued basically that it was needed to close a legal loophole that would allow same-sex couples to marry. They actually denied having any intent to change the laws regarding domestic partnership.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Stewart. And we'll hear now from Mr. Minter by way of 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Your Honor, with regard to the question of possible adverse consequences, you know, with apologies to Shakespeare, same-sex couples have come here today to praise marriage, not to bury it. Petitioners deeply value the tradition of marriage and wish to participate in it with all the joy and responsibility that brings. There's absolutely no evidence in the record here or elsewhere that permitting same-sex couples to marry elsewhere has any...
I thought when you invoked Shakespeare, you were going to invoke the line, "What's in a name?"
Also would have been very appropriate.
Also with apologies to Shakespeare, I thought you were going to say a rose by any other name would smell just like.
Names are very important, Your Honor.
Well, Mr. Minter, on that point, opposing counsel said, were we to agree with you, that we would have to refer the matter to the legislature because this court has no authority to define marriage. What's your response to that?
The appropriate remedy in this case is to do exactly what this court did in Perez, which is issue a mandate directing the state to issue marriage licenses without discriminating based on gender or sexual orientation. All this court needs to do is not draft any new statutory language, just strike the discriminatory language that was added in 1977.
But, counsel, Proposition 22 was not particularly complicated. 14 words long. It's really pretty clear. why shouldn't we leave this to the people to decide?
Because the case poses a direct constitutional question that is within the authority and responsibility of this court to resolve. The statutory classifications at issue in Section 300, and if the court finds it applies, Section 308.5, violate a fundamental right, the fundamental right to marry, and classify based on sex and sexual orientation, and those are constitutional questions that it is clearly within the court's authority to resolve. Remedy question, that discriminatory language was added with the six words between a man and a woman in 1977, and this court in Hofshire and Kopp and other cases has made clear that if it finds an equal protection violation, it has to do one of two things: either strike the statute entirely or reform it by getting rid of the discriminatory exclusion. And the choice there depends on which the court thinks would be more in line with legislative intent. I think here it's obvious that neither the legislature nor certainly the petitioners nor anyone else would want the court to strike the marriage statute, but all it needs to do is reform the discriminatory language that was added in 1977 in those six words. Your Honor, if you'll permit me, just wanted to address one more point about privacy. In addition to conferring public validation, entering into the status of marriage also gives individuals and families the highest possible degree of privacy. Just by telling someone, your friends, colleagues, neighbors, the world, that you are married, that in itself automatically conveys a whole multiplicity of very well understood meanings that prevent couples from having to explain their adult relationships or their relationships with their own children. The word marriage itself and the status of marriage itself really acts as a kind of protective shield. And the petitioners in this case yearn for the privacy and the respect that marriage provides and that only marriage can give them, and that no non-marital status can provide.
Thank you, Mr. Minter. The court wants to thank all counsel for their presentations. The matters of the six consolidated appeals are submitted, and the court is in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All rise.